Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Dozens of students protested racism on Texas A&M's campus today.
The rally was called February 9th is Every Day. On that date, a group of mostly black high school students visiting A&M's campus were verbally assaulted with racist language and told to go home. News 3's Abby Knight joins us live in the newsroom to tell us what the protesters are demanding. Hi, Abby.
Carla and Steve, I spoke to the organizer of today's rally. Emilio Bernal told me they'd like to see a few changes to the course's requirements for Aggie students.
We're not seeking to add courses to what's already required, but rather replacing those courses that maybe aren't so critical.
Bernal and fellow activists think new seminars announced recently by university leaders called Community of Respect shouldn't just be for incoming freshmen, but for all students and faculty. They'd also like a racial justice course added to the core curriculum. Junior Tyler San Miguel was shocked by what happened February 9th.
I've never heard anything like that, like the 3 years I've been here, so to hear that and to think that Aggies would do something like that is kind of crazy.
But San Miguel believes the actions of a few students on that day shouldn't mean everyone has to take the courses.
If this is all just because of that one incident that happened, I think that's taking it a little too far.
Rodney Young participated in the rally. He says racism has impacted his years on campus.
They claim that everyone here is an Aggie, but so many times, on so many occasions, I don't feel like that.
At the rally, protesters stood side by side with duct tape over their mouths while holding posters bringing awareness to racism they say is experienced on campus every day.
For many students and faculty of color, February 9th is every day. There's nothing new that happened at February 9th.
To implement a course would be relatively hard, but I feel like if they cared enough about the people of color, they would at least attempt it.
Young says education and awareness would only help keep more hate from happening.
I wouldn't say every student of color has experienced it because everybody's experience is different, but for me personally, on several occasions, every year, and I'm a senior.
Texas A&M's anti-racism group says the university referenced the racial slurs on February 9th as an incident. They say that wording encouraged them to organize today's protest. In the newsroom, Abby Knight, News 3.
All right, Abby, thank you very much. And after an investigation, university police turned over the findings to the Brazos County Attorney's Office.
That office declined to take any action, and the university says one student involved in the harassment is no longer associated with Texas A&M.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, May 12th, 2016. So I have been told we should be here tomorrow, fourth installment, our book study session on Harriet A. Washington's phenomenal text, Medical Apartheid. Lots of great information. I think a lot of folks have thoroughly enjoyed the book. Should be required reading for any black person, particularly any black person who says they are serious about getting a better understanding of what racism is, how it works. Tomorrow, Medical Apartheid session number 4. Our broadcast today, we're always eager, one of our favorite guests, to have on the program. I know I personally remember that incident. You heard the audio clip at the beginning of the program. There was national attention on what happened to these young scholars, teens, black teens who visited the campus of Texas A&M. I was curious to hear what our guest for today's program thought about that, if he was approached when all the hubbub around that kerfuffle were going on, to get his views on that, as well as some of the other things that have been taking place since we last spoke with him towards the end of 2015. Our guest for today's broadcast, making his seventh visit to the context of white supremacy, is a professor, associate professor at said university, Texas A&M. His research interests include philosophy, jurisprudence, Africana studies, and gender studies. He's in the Department of Philosophy, and his primary areas of interests are critical race theory and Africana philosophy. Always a pleasure to have him on the broadcast. Really excited to hear from him once again. Joining us live, our guest, Dr. Tommy Curry. Dr. Curry, are you with us, sir?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with us once again. For folks, this might be their first time hearing from you. Anything you think would be helpful for folks to know about you before we get started?
Well, there's so much floating around the net now. It's hard to know when to begin. Well, mainly my research interests, as you said, are critical race theory. One of the foundational pillars that I take from that movement is the realist tradition, which suggests that racism in the United States is or may actually be permanent. So the questions that I ask in my research are, how do we deal with the permanence of racism thesis? How do we have a viable political theory that allows us to deal with the realities and the structural and ideological reproduction of white supremacy that doesn't rely on things like the good faith of white Americans, the assumption that American democracy simply progresses towards more racial equality, or even more profoundly or practically, how do we deal with the realities of anti-black death? And that last question specifically has kind of led to a new area of research where I'm extremely interested in how black men and boys deal with the realities of death and, you know, what I call necrophobia. They're constantly living in a world that's haunted by death. So these are the kind of major research interests that I'm working on right now.
Outstanding. We will try to cover as much material as we can in the time that we have you, and encourage listeners to dial in if they have questions for Dr. Curry as well. I think a lot of folks saw what happened at your institution, Texas A&M, with the students who visited the campus. I wanted to start there. Did you hear about the incident? What were your thoughts on what transpired? And did anyone approach you on how the campus should respond to this situation, or even you possibly doing some teaching around what happened about this incident?
Well, the first thing to understand is that the campuses like Texas A&M that are largely conservative and overwhelmingly white, these kind of incidences are not unusual. It just happened that this specific case got national recognition. I think that when you look at how predominantly white college campuses and institutions are ran, the conversation in some of the clips that you heard about diversity is usually just public relations talk. There is no structural adjustment within institutions at levels of presidents, provosts, or deans that actually want more faculty of color there. One of the reasons for this is that usually these predominantly white institutions, especially when they're conservative, build themselves with certain ideological foundations. So at Texas A&M, for instance, the big ideological pillar is the Aggie family. And that Aggie family historically has been overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly racist. And as you can tell, if you go to Cushing, which is our archival library, heavily involved with the Klan. So when you have a history like that, part of the ideological cement that holds the traditions together is this kind of notion of white supremacy. So given that it's a historical context, look at how the university is set up. The way that most professors exist at Texas A&M is that they're one or two within a plethora of white faculty. So in the College of Liberal Arts, for instance, there's only 23 tenure-track black faculties. There's only 40 teaching black faculty. That's including graduate students, research assistants, et cetera. So in the College of Liberal Arts, which is mainly the college that's responsible for educating, bringing liberal education, teaching about race, class, gender, sexuality, et cetera, there's massive underrepresentation there, right? Because you're talking about hundreds of other professors, and then you're talking about a pocket of 40 people, including graduate students that are teaching. So in given that kind of, you know, marginalization, there's no way that that small number of professors, and again, we're assuming here the best case scenario where they all actually teach on race, class, or gender issues at the university, that those small numbers of professors could ever affect the overall students or the overall population that takes classes in the College of Liberal Arts. So when you hear people say, oh, this was a racist incident, we want classes on social justice, we want classes on racism, X, Y, and Z, understand that while that may be something students want, institutions operate in such a way that those classes will never affect the overall quality or content or way of thinking of the student population. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons that places like Texas A&M are so the University of Texas or UT, is that the conservatism of the institution allows it to maintain this public relations face. It says, oh, we know we're a white university, let's constantly bring in students, but at the same time, it doesn't structurally adjust to it. And what do I mean by that? I mean that it never brings in a critical mass of senior black faculty that allows the institution to change from within. There are not campus conversations. There is not a culture here that's built around exploring white supremacy or exploring anti-blackness. So what you do is you hire junior faculty to say, oh, look, we've increased black people. You don't retain them. You don't see them through for tenure. Or you have senior faculty. You make sure that you don't retain them if they get counter offers or if they decide to go elsewhere. So what it looks like is that you're constantly bringing in people, but you don't let them go through the ranks of tenure to associate, to full, that allows them institutional power and institutional positions that actually change the culture and change what the administration looks like. The administration is largely white-run, so that maintains that whatever they see as progressive trickles down to the students, and largely that means that it overlooks racial discrimination, and it certainly never has a conversation about white supremacy. So that's why Texas A&M is able to advertise itself as a conservative university that keeps bringing in the same white students that have the same values, which is why this incident happened. They have people here that roll with the KKK. I was constantly on a watch list for a few years when I was teaching the hip-hop seminar. They have avowed white supremacists that often show up to talks on race and racism. You know, in my department, for instance, we have one black person that came in, the first black person in the history of it, to still have issues of racial harassment. It's a black male. We have issues of sexual harassment against them. So these are all problems that exist in this kind of, you know, academic geography. So this is not, you know, I've heard the conversations. I did a talk with the Deltas about it and a few other, you know, student organizations like Amnesty International. This is not a place where that kind of behavior is not going to continue happening. Remember, when Obama was being elected, they had the noose incident, they had the egging incident, they had the slave incident, right? So this is not so far out of character for places like, you know, A&M or other southern universities generally, that people are really trying to seriously change the culture that's involved with it. This is just window dressing. This is a public relations issue. This is not an issue of this academic institution or other southern academic institutions trying to do better.
Wow. Fascinating.
When you're inside the institution, you know, there's some very real things that, you know, that the public doesn't understand, you know, and institutions just like society are built in stability and they're autopoietic. They reproduce themselves. So that reproduction is both at a material level or a physical level with who you hire, and then it's at an ideological level. So when you talk about the majority of people that constitute university faculty, these are largely colorblind white liberals at best. These are not going to be, you know, even the southern universities, they're not hiring southern black people, working class black people to teach about race and racism, because you get very different structural and economic critiques of white supremacy from southern people that you generally don't get from liberals from the north or even black liberals that come up from the north to a research institution in the south.
Wow. The public relations that happened, window dressing, as you said, that happened around this incident, I would think is largely over. People have moved on. They have other things to talk about. They said that one of the students is gone. And the institution of Texas A&M, I would say the institution of white supremacy, rolls on. This was just a minor blip on the radar screen. Moved on. No problems here.
Yeah. I mean, and see, that's what I'm saying is that, I mean, even, you know, I think I made this criticism about student movements as well. Institutions like universities are meant to outlast social instability. That's why professors have tenure. That's why they're, you know, the ivory towers. If you look at places like Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, another institution that I went to for a while, you know, there's Fainter Hall, which is, they say is riot-proof, right? See, institutions are built because they know that they outlast social situations or circumstances. Revolutions can't happen into eternity. So as long as the university outlasts the students that are there, that are having the social protests, the administration's fine. The tenured professors are fine, right? The energy of youth and student protests and dissent are fleeting. Right, that's why you have these flares. People get so frustrated, they protest, they make demands. The administration gives them something, they quiet down. 2 or 3 years later, these same people are going to fly out the way. You got new people, and that energy is going to die out. And that's why I think you've seen some of the letdown of the Black Lives Matter movement as well, because the student protests are going 2 and 3 years, and the same people that are doing the protests, that are organizing their leaders on campus, are going through the process. They're still becoming sophomores, you know, juniors and seniors, and then they have to get jobs to support themselves. So until we actually have a sustainable engagement with the university and its relationship to the Black public, then you're not going to see the kind of transformations that come from cases like this. And given the admissions process and the way that, you know, predominantly the only reason Black people, especially Black males, are recruited into these kinds of environments are if they play sports or, you know, have some kind of other athletic scholarship. So there's not going to be a mass of Black students that can overwhelm the administration or overwhelm the college to actually change things at a curricular or institutional level. You know, so these are very concrete and practical problems that are beyond kind of our insistence of constant critique and constantly pointing out white supremacy. We don't control faculty lines. We don't control budgets. So that means that we'll never be able to amass either the recruitment to get students in or put forth those efforts, and we certainly don't have the power to decide how many lines certain departments get, so they're not diversifying quick enough to actually bring in or meet student need. So that passion, again, dies out because it's all emotional. It's not based on an understanding of history or political economics or philosophy or the ways that we want to actually generate and sustain student engagements. That's why Black Studies worked so well back in the 60s, because you had Black students saying they want a curriculum to teach them about the history and the material conditions that made them upset, that made them dissatisfied. When you had that synergy between youth and passion, as well as the intellectual and historical basis of why you feel upset, why you want to protest, why you want to burn things down, that combination leads to greater results. Universities understand that, and that's why they've tried to quiet Black Studies down. They've toned down what they reward in terms of the revolutionary or socially transformative rhetoric of institutions and disciplines. So we're not having conversations about poverty. We're not having conversations about the relationship between politics, economics, and kind of cultural spheres of influence, you know, like media, like police, things of that sort. We've cut all that out. Now we want to talk about discourse, representation, symbols, how we feel, lemonade, hashtags. You've replaced the things that teach people the basis of changing society and being transformative into hashtag logic so that people can just express emotion and express anger and then not outlast the institutions they're trying to challenge. So it's quite disheartening when you look at it from the perspective of a professor, or you look at it from the perspective of someone that actually wishes institutions would have to run up against a very strong and socially organized public.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Dr. Tommy Curry. Speaking of anger, also was very much looking forward to getting your thoughts. You have not been with us since November, so I think that was before mm-hmm. the primary started and everything. I think at that time, people still were not really taking Donald J. Trump seriously. I think most people, I think that would be accurate to say, most people, I don't mm-hmm. think, thought that he was going to win the Republican nominee. I don't think most people thought that he had a serious chance to take the White House. Now it looks like he is the presumptive Republican nominee and has mm-hmm. a pretty reasonable chance of winning the White House. What does this to you signal about racism, white supremacy in 2016, and that he's amassed so much support from white voters?
You know, Gus, it's, you know, I think on the program before, we had a long conversation about the importance of history, right? And you know, and people, you know, people constantly disagree, I guess, with the supposed radicality of some of the positions that I take. But, you know, if you look at this historically, you can see that, you know, racial progress or even the perceived symbol of racial progress in America leads to a backlash, right? You saw this with the civil rights movement and, you know, affirmative action. You saw it back in Reconstruction, you know, with the Reconstruction Amendments and the Union of Jim Crow. This is how the world works in America. This is built into the structure of racial progress. It's the kind of, it's the intellige of civil rights, so to speak, in America. So given that, I predicted that Donald Trump would win the Republican Party, and I also predicted that it would be a battle between him and the Democratic machine, because I was like, you're going to see superdelegates try to crush the class analysis of someone like a Bernie Sanders, because he's actually given a kind of a political and economic analysis of how racism and class warfare and health care and all these things are felling the working class American. I was like, this is going to be too far. This is too far left, even for Democrats. So I said that it was going to be between Hillary and Trump. And in that world, I think, given the record of Clinton, I think Trump has a very good chance of beating her. I think that people who underestimated Trump are not really reading the signs of the political situation in the United States. They're not looking at the devolution of the white middle class and how that economic loss triggers certain kind of racial frictions. I don't think that they're looking at the kind of ideological pull, the allure that someone like a Donald Trump has to American exceptionalism. I think all these things combined with their fear of becoming a minority and leaving the Obama administration, given what we knew happened with the Tea Party, given the kind of conservative flare-up, the conservative pushback against what they perceived to be Obamacare and liberal policies, to me this was you know, the writing was on the wall. I think that in the world for black people, this is a very, very dangerous time, because you have to remember that the language that's coming from Donald Trump is very xenophobic, is very ethnocentric, and is very nationalistic. And the problem with that is that in a world where you have white people who feel that their security, both racially and economically, are predicated on black people's gains, means that if Donald Trump wins, or what's pushing it forward, is that he wants to stop that. So the language that you get about, we don't want Mexicans, we're going to build a wall, the language you get against the queer community, the language you get against black people, the language you get about Muslims, all this signals to the rest of the white republic, the white Americans in this country, is that America is still a white republic. Now, given that you're coming from a post-Obama era, there's a few reasons we should be very, very concerned about that. What happens to all those moderate whites that voted for Obama 8 years ago, now that they're in their mid-30s? What happens to those college-educated 22, 23-year-olds now that they're 32, 33? Are they still moderate? Have they gotten the kind of economic gains where they feel like Obama actually benefited them? Or do they feel like they lost something? And if they feel like they lost something, be it perceived, be it traumatically, be it that they didn't get the job they want, does that put them in the camp of Trump? So, in other words, think about all the reactionaries. Think about all the middle class or lower middle class whites that are fighting to stay in the middle class and not going down to the lower class. How does that class dynamic, fighting against poverty, code itself in a kind of racial consciousness? Do they feel like they're losing jobs to Mexicans? Do they feel like they're safe in America because people look like Muslims? Do they think they're going to be robbed or raped by black people, right? When you look at the Dylann Roof situation, how is white supremacy and the notion of black people or black men being rapists especially kind of working its way into the fear that white people have of losing America? These are very dangerous times, because Donald Trump is saying, you have a lot to be fearful of. We need to take America back to make it our own so that we could quiet your fears. And that language has traditionally been used by tyrants and dictators, but has a certain appeal in America where white people now feel that this is not their country, where they feel like people who are black and brown are going to outnumber them and take their jobs and transform their legacy and rewrite their history. So even the arguments you see in the academy that are against ethnic studies or post-colonial studies or black studies, these things are being challenged because they resonate with the kinds of fears that whites have about their own normative identity. The same thing with the LGBTQ challenges and bills. These are about normative whiteness. This is about the normative American. This is why you have the rise of conservatism. And for us to not link that to an economic downturn within white people and the way that white people see racial interests as being mixed with their class interests above black and brown people is a very, very dangerous thing to miss, because it means that if we don't see that, then we yet again have to appeal to white people's goodwill. We have to appeal to the idea that white people are not crazy enough to vote for Trump, whereas Trump is saying, you may be crazy, you may be crazy, you may vote for me, but I'll help your pockets. I'll make America white again. I'll give you some kind of reason to believe that democracy really is for you, because these people who are dissatisfied ultimately don't think democracy is working for them, because they think they're the majority. They should be winning, but they see themselves losing, right, in terms of population and demographics, in terms of politics, right? Because the fact is, now they see this push. Black people, Mexicans are registering, Latinos are saying they're standing up to Trump. These things worry white people who fundamentally believe that they should own the republic. And I don't see a lot of analysis coming out that way. Most of the ways that we're talking about this election is revolving around Donald Trump is crazy, this shouldn't be happening. Mind you, it still is happening. And then we're putting all our eggs in the basket of Hillary Clinton. And I think that's a very, very dangerous thing to do. And most of the conversations that's even coming out of academics is this kind of identity politic, being that she's a woman, right? We keep forgetting she's a white woman, and white women have had a long history of tyranny, of being tyrannical, violent, castrating, lynching, right? This is all part of white women's history from the 1860s forward. And we have this issue of whether or not she's actually in the interest of black people, right? And this is where the kind of ideological disposition of black people voting Democratic and voting on a kind of a progressive bend is actually working against us. Where most people generally vote based on ideological association, party association. But in this case, it's so important that we get clear on the issues. So questions like crime, her repeated issues that she has with black males as super predators, as criminals, right? She recently had a statement months ago, or I think early 2015, where she was like, look, if we're all honest, everyone's scared of a black man in the hood, right? These things are problematic because they not only tell us her unconscious bias or her very deliberate personal biases, but they also tell us that this may be the way that she tries to direct policy. And given the reason, the issues we're having with police brutality, death, poverty, incarceration, that may not be the best bet for us. So, you know, I think it's a mess. I think it's a mess that's created by a certain white paranoia about becoming a minority, a racial minority, and their perceived losses under Obama. The question is, when you're a minority, especially a racial minority, that's not very organized and so separate by class interests, because middle-class black people are vastly separate from working-class black people in terms of their issues and in terms of how they interpret poor black people's realities. I think that, you know, black people are in for a very, very rough 4 years, if not 8 years, because things are only going to get worse. You know, a social movement like Black Lives Matter is not enough to overturn a governmental and political machine. You know, as much as you may like the public electoral college, superdelegates are there to ensure that certain machines and political platforms get carried out despite the will of the public. So if we're still in the 21st century having superficial arguments about turning people's opinions and attitudes, and we're not having serious arguments about policy and economic interest and how certain legal doctrines, et cetera, are going to exploit certain power dynamics, then we're not doing a very good job exposing the ways that white supremacy and classism and anti-blackness are converging around the black population in the United States.
Fascinating there. Couple quick points I wanted to get you to respond to. I guess first, just when you started out, when you said the importance of history, I think you said it last time you were on the program, the end of 2015, just talking about the importance of understanding history so that you can get a broader, more comprehensive of why things are happening right now. Even as you said before, why, if you're a black person and you're upset, why are you upset? What are the forces that are playing into you being angry about what's happening to you, what's happening to us black people on the whole? I think earlier this year I was having a conversation, and exactly what you said, just let's just look at the record. When there's been some, even if it's just a perceived notion, even if it's not based in fact, just a perceived notion that black people are getting a little uppity, they don't know their place, they're revolting, rioting, standing up to racism, white supremacy in any way, shape, form, where white people feel like they either lost something, they might be losing something somehow, some way. Their system is being destabilized by dark people what tends to happen, particularly if you just want to look at presidential elections. If you want to look at post-Reconstruction violence, where white people felt like, particularly in the South, oh man, we lost our slaves, we lost the war, our whole way of life. We need to get rolling. Mass violence against black people, mass lynchings, rapings, killings of black people in the South, particularly against black males. What happens in the 1960s? You have quote-unquote civil rights movement, Black Panthers, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all these other people, Rosa Parks, doing all this to work against racism. White people feel, oh my gosh, black people are out of control. Law and order politics, Nixon gets elected. I said, to me, this looks very similar, particularly to what happened during the 1960s, where you have the white lash and you get the election of Nixon, Richard Nixon, in 1968. It looks exactly the same to me with a lot of the ways that the rhetoric that Donald Trump is using. Maybe it's not exactly law and order that Nixon came out talking in that time period, but it seems kind of close with the put the wall up, we've got these rapists coming over, we're losing, there's chaos, I will instill white order if you put me in the White House, particularly his jargon over the last, I guess, 8 years now against President Obama and him being there and what have you. And I think at large, white people, what's been directed against President Obama over the last 8 years, even though I would totally agree with, I think, a lot of black people who would say that this has not really been a major benefit directly to a lot of black people, just having him in the White House the past 8 years. There was a report in the New York Times, just because, and I also thought it was extremely important, where you said that people just saying that, oh, this Donald Trump guy is crazy, like that just being the analysis, this guy's crazy, there's no way that he's going to win, you know, white people are not crazy enough to vote for him, and it's even crazy that he's gotten this far. I've been telling people, number one, I remind people what the late Dr. Francis Cress Welsing said about being very cautious about using that word crazy. If we're talking about the conduct of white people as it relates to racism, white supremacy, that's not the most accurate word. Even if the behavior is pathological, it would be an error to call this crazy if they're doing exactly what they set out to do, which the record suggests. But there was a report in the New York Times that kind of confirmed some of my thoughts. I think a lot of white people are being very dishonest when they say that they're not going to vote for Trump, or they don't like him, or he's, you know, some kook or some crackpot. He's not presidential. There's no way he could be a statesman that people could take seriously to represent this country. They had a report in the New York Times yesterday, and it says, how many people support Trump but don't admit it? And I'm just going to read a small portion to kind of get your thoughts. So they mentioned some of the very things that you talked about. We've got these Muslims here. We need to put this wall up. We've got all these Mexicans who've come over here illegally. So he says, these views taken together have provided a foundation for the strong correlation between the support for Trump and white ethnocentrism and white racial resentment. One method of ranking whites on ethnocentrism is to measure the degree to which they believe Caucasians are mostly trustworthy, intelligent, industrious, and less violent than African Americans, Hispanics, and other minorities, non-white people. These are the kinds of questions that prompt certain respondents in phone surveys to mask their views and provide socially acceptable answers instead. I thought that was really important, because that suggests that white people are not ignorant about racism if they know enough to mask their racist views. Last paragraph, it reads, the accompanying chart, which uses data to provide the Times by Mark Hetherington and Drew Englehart, political scientist at Vanderbilt, shows that white Republicans are the most ethnocentric of all voters, but also that there are substantial numbers of ethnocentric white Democrats and white independents. And it goes on to talk about how there is a healthy amount of specifically anti-black resentment in not just the Republican Party, but amongst Democrats and independents as well. And Donald Trump may be able to use this to get his path to the White House. What would your response to that be?
Well, I think that's accurate. You see, when we, let me see how I can phrase this, the liberal conception of politics that we generally teach students, that we have in the public, suggests that politics is merely the extension of reason, of an argument, and a kind of a normative vision of democracy or equality or whatever the case may be amongst a whole bunch of rational individuals, right? And this is what we largely think of. We have presidential candidates that speak to us. We believe them on the issues. We believe Hillary Clinton when she says she cares about black people, even though her record doesn't show it. But we believe her more than Trump. She's better for us than Trump, so that's who we cast our vote for. But then think of it this way. What if the world is built around people who don't like their position in the world, people who don't think that you can actually talk beyond groups, that all people are either A or B. Well, then in that world, then people like Trump understand that you have to accumulate power, that if you can't talk to people who are A's because all the B's are dissatisfied, then it isn't to convince A's, it's to grow your number of B's, right? And if politics works in that way, then it means that the way that we've conceptualized notions of race and equality are fundamentally wrong. Because what we've always tried to do is convince people who may be racist, like all the B's, to come over to the A side and embrace equality and embrace justice. But in a world where people don't believe you can speak, where there is no rational connection between people who vote for Trump and want America to be a white republic and want to get Muslims out of the country and liberals, then the question you have to ask yourself is this: will those liberals do things based purely on their good intentions? Will they vote? Will they cast a vote simply because they want the world to be equal, even if that equal world means they lose? You see, and this is the weakness of how we think of the liberal argument. You have to remember that if true equality comes about, if equality for racial minorities comes about, that necessarily has to divest white people of their privileges and economic standing in this country. So if black people start getting jobs, if black people start getting the kinds of employment they deserve, right, like black women get the jobs they deserve after being, you know, the highest group and getting, you know, bachelor degrees in this country, that means a whole lot of white men and white women aren't going to get those jobs. That means those networks of nepotism that we have set up for the, you know, the old white boys and I'll say old white ladies networks, that these things fall through. What's that world going to look like? Do you trust the white liberal to vote for that world where none of the things that were built on white supremacy work for them anymore? Because remember, that's what the black progressive and black liberals are asking. You're asking the white person who has all this privilege, this power, this political recognition, this social standing, to share it with you, to give up some of theirs so that you can have it too. And that's the problem with why you see so many people underestimating Trump. Because they said, no way would people who are rational and good-willed vote for Trump. But if you look at the history of racism, you have to admit there are some people, a large majority of white people in this country, who are not good-willed, who are not rational, who do not aspire for justice and equality. And in that world, they aspire for power and racial interest and white superiority. And that's why people like Trump are coming ahead. So I think that article is correct. And I think that it also points out the immaturity of the kind of political analysis that we're getting from these pundits that are feeding the black community these narratives of, you know, Clinton's triumph, these narratives that, you know, the process is still working, that Clinton is legitimately winning. You know, all this is just pacifying the black public. Because it means that we don't have to critically engage. Think about it. If we say Hillary's the solution to Trump, we don't have to critically engage how Hillary got there. We don't have to ask very simple, very important questions like, who's controlling the Democratic process if the Democratic Party that we've already said that we generally vote for determines who's going to win before they even run? Like, think about how dangerous that is. Right now it's Hillary and Trump, but what happens if you have someone in the future that looks like Hillary but has the politics of Trump under Democratic ticket? Will we be able to understand the difference? Or will we simply say that we believe her because she's a woman? Do we trust white women now? Is that the way the history's played out? Do we have a reason to trust liberal white women to do what's in the best interest of black people and brown people and poor people and Muslims? Because that's not how history was written. I could have sworn that all these other groups, the Arab, the yellow man from Asia, the black man, the brown man, the red man, I thought they were all called rapists in the 20th century. So we have to be very careful how we want to read white women's vulnerability as being representative of progressive democratic goals. Black people become too trusting in that. And again, that's because we lack both the historical and the economic analysis to understand how politics is working to give us certain predetermined outcomes. This is just to show the process is already determined. The superdelegates have already decided that they're voting for Clinton no matter what. So this is almost fait accompli. The question is, does the platform and the process decide for Trump or for Hillary? And those are two very dangerous options for black people in a world where certain people have the resources to make sure that black people don't get jobs, that you get further rollbacks on affirmative action, you get more police departments that are being militarized and armed, killing black people, especially poor black people, even though we say we care for them the most. They're the most disadvantaged, yet they receive the least amount of attention when we're talking about actual remedies. So it's a very, very dangerous time, and I think that that article is absolutely correct, that we're overlooking the kind of dissatisfaction dissent that white people have and how that generates certain social and cultural conditions that empower white people to actually lean more on institutionalized practices of racism, anti-blackness, and white supremacy.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. I had in my notes where you were talking about, particularly in this era, this push to make sure that we have what is called, I think the term used was normative whiteness as it relates to some of the other issues that have been coming up around these transgender bathroom access and some of the other things that have been happening. My question I wanted to get to, what is your understanding or what is your view on the comparisons that are made when people say that what's happening with, like, North Carolina HB2 bill about, you know, bathroom access, comparing that to earlier eras of white supremacy, like Jim Crow era when they had the signs up, niggers can't use this bathroom or water fountain or whatever the case is. What do you think that, of that in, comparison? But just before I get to that question, just what do you mean when you say normative whiteness?
So when I'm talking about normative whiteness, I'm talking about the idea that there is an ideal white citizen, an ideal white country, an ideal world where white people control, right? I think that's it's an aspiration. It's a view of what should happen, what white America should look like. And I think that that's what appeals to a lot of the white people that are voting for Trump, right? Think of it like there was a, you know, when people say, you know, back in the day, things used to be better. Mm. And I always cringe when people say that because they're like, oh, you know, back in the day, you know, people used to understand each other and help each other. And I'm always confused because I was born in 79. So if you're going, and that was pretty rough in Louisiana. So if you're going any further back than that, then we're talking literally about segregation and Jim Crow. So I don't understand what that is. So that's the America that people like Trump are talking about. Right, when people say they could raise themselves up by the bootstraps, they're talking about places that don't have, you know, discrimination law, where there is no workplace discrimination or harassment law. Right, this is the world and vision that they have in their minds. So that's what I mean when I'm saying normative whiteness. There's a vision that they have about how whites are the norm and how whites should be positioned above other groups, and that's what they're fighting and aiming for.
Outstanding. So glad I asked that. That reminds me when Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., who is significantly older than you, but when he talks about the greatest generation and there's this nostalgia for the way things were back in the 1950s and 1940s when you could lynch a black person and no one cared. In fact, it would be cause for a picnic or something.
Right.
So what's your view about the comparison, as I said, the HB2 and transgender issues about who gets access to the bathrooms and what have you, and comparing that and saying that this is similar to, you know, we had signs up saying blacks can't use this facility or can't go to this bathroom, et cetera.
Right. You know, look, I think that anytime there's discrimination, be it against women, same-sex couples, you know, now trans peoples, it's compared to black people. Right. So when they were going through same-sex marriages compared to black people and anti-miscegenation laws, right? And part of me thinks, like, okay, it's a comparison, you know, whatever. But the other part of me thinks, too, that we've become so diluted in terms of what we understand oppression to be that we cannot make accurate distinctions between levels of oppression. And here's what I mean. So when we compare things like, you know, HB2, right, where I think it's illegal, I think it's discrimination, I don't support that, right? I'm not into discriminating against any group. But there is a very real danger between saying something like, you know, same-sex marriage benefits or, you know, transgender rights in this case is the same thing as a history of genocide, right, against a group of people. And I think that what happens, especially in the academy, is that because so many things are based on recognition that you have to have liberal politics being against or for whatever cause on a whatever day, that what we're missing is that, one, this comes about because of a fear, a puritanical fear that white people have used against all groups, right? Because remember, you remember when they were saying black men were rapists, you know, they had to protect white women from black men. Or black people were savages, or they were going to pedophiles, right? All this stuff has been said in history. It's the same kind of racial stereotype codified within this gender notion now. So that's the first point. The second point is that we have to understand that acts of discrimination have always happened within societies. But what delineates things like what's going on with HB 2 and the fact that it's been recently, you know, chastised by the Supreme Court, right, or, the Justice Department saying that it's unconstitutional is those kind of things are in your face, they're legislative, they're policy. We're undergoing a very real reality where poor black people, men and women, are being killed. And nobody's making the argument that dead black people in the 21st century is a violation of their due process or their 14th Amendment, right? That's the difference. The difference is what happens to a group who's being discriminated that's recognizable as having rights such that the government says you're violating their rights, and another group of people who are dehumanized, victims of slavery, who are being killed, and they're debating do they or do they not have rights, right? That's the difference. So I think that if you make the comparison on the basis of discrimination, is it discriminatory in the sense that it's segregationist? Yes. Is it discriminatory and racist or oppressive to the same extent that you still have the people that fought against segregation being actively killed, you know, in jail or by the police or in society by white vigilantes the same way? No. Right? And those are two vastly important scopes of history and magnitude that have to be considered in these kinds of conversations.
Do you get any pushback in the academy or anyone else saying, hey, Dr. Curry, that's just oppression Olympics there, man. Hey, oppression is oppression. You know, you can't be judging levels of treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I have a real funny story about that. So I always tell liberals that, you know, people are constantly saying we shouldn't play the oppression Olympics, but they're always going for the gold, you know. Because what you find is groups say that constantly, especially with the work I do on black men. They're like, oh, you know, we shouldn't play the oppression Olympics. All groups are oppressed. And I'm like, yeah, but that's just not the case, right? You don't sit down and say, you know, there are 900,000, there are 850,000 black men in jail, and we shouldn't be concerned about that because there's 210,000 women in jail. And if you say that you're not supposed to care about these 215,000, when you have these 800,000 black men, then that's oppression Olympics. Then yet again, I'm saying, what is the scope of the argument? So, when you tell someone all oppression is the same, are you suggesting that someone who is denied say same partner benefits is the same as people who are being systematically murdered and victims of genocide? So even like when you think about our reaction to Boko Haram, we were so focused on the women that were taken that we completely missed all the young boys who were completely slaughtered, the men and boys who were completely slaughtered. So how do we even comprehend that reality? Like, there are people who are no longer existing anymore, and we're saying that you can't compare death to discrimination? So if I'm denied something that I want, that's the same as taking out a whole group of people, right? And that's, again, this is what I'm saying. This is the problem with the way identity politics works. The liberal paradigm has us believing, and this happens in the academy all the time around white women, right? The liberal paradigm has us believing that white women are a minority. And I say, okay, how are white women a minority in the academy? And they're saying, well, they're underrepresented. And my question is always, underrepresented to who? There's like 615,000 white women in the American universities. There's like 650,000 white men. So you're outnumbered by 30 or 40,000. Now, there may be degrees where you don't have the same number of professorships or tenure track. That all very well may be the case. So I'm not overlooking that. But that's the delineation between white men. When you talk about black people or other minorities, you're talking about 110,000. So when you look at, there are six of the number of white women in the academy. So how do you take a group that's massively more educated, has more wealth, is the second richest group in the country, and compare it to groups who are like the 32nd? Like, am I supposed to understand that oppression is being equal? And the only way we could do that is if we cover off all the actual inequity. And we say that none of the actual poverty, none of the life expectancy, none of the disease, none of that matters. All that matters is the relationship they have to white men. And since everybody's disadvantaged to white men, everyone's equal. And this happens all the time when we talk about things like the gender wage gap, 77 cents. But I was like, black men make 64 cents on a dollar. Black women generally make either equal to that or 61 cents, depending on the study you read, right?
And black men work 15 to 20 hours more just for a 3 cent, 3 or 4 cent differential. So how do we comprehend that there is supposed to be this huge oppression that some people seem to benefit from, that you have everybody else on the bottom, and somehow we're supposed to conceptualize that as equal? I just think it's a dishonest argument. I think it's an argument that allows certain privileged groups who may not be at the top, but certainly close to the top, or in many cases marrying the top, right? So when you talk about white women specifically, we're talking about women who may earn less than white men but marry white men, so they benefit from the wealth of white men, right? When you talk about these kinds of groups, if you keep playing these identity politics and, you know, neoliberal calculus game, arithmetic games, then you never get to the real argument, which is, why is it that certain groups who call themselves minorities still benefit more than every other group? You have to think about this. White women and white men benefit more than every other racial group in the country. They're the top two groups. And we're still claiming that somehow we need to understand some kind of intersectional relationship between them. That's not how oppression and structural racism works, right? The question is, how is it that there's an accumulation of wealth, political representation, and power around whiteness, where even that overturns gender, where even women in that race benefit more than every other racial group and gender, right? And I think that's where we have to start really challenging some of these liberal notions of disadvantage, because it doesn't make sense. If you study any of this stuff empirically, it just doesn't make sense. You know, I think I talked about it before. It's the same argument with intersectionality. You claim that black men have privilege, but then we say, okay, fine, let's test it. Show us these areas of privilege, and nobody could find them. You know, I mean, the best you could come up with is wage, but when you look at hours worked, it just disappears. You know, these things really set us back in terms of the overall understanding that scholars, young scholars and students have about their own conditions. Because nobody wants to say, this group is most oppressed and we need policy to deal with it. Nobody's coming out and saying, listen, these people are most disaffected, are most affected by these situations, so we need policy to deal with it. You know, even when you talk about domestic abuse, these groups of people are most affected by psycho violence. We need policy to. Nobody's doing that. You know, all liberal arts scholars are arguing about is identity politics and white supremacy and, you know, heteropatriarchy, and we drop all these words and nobody knows anything about the populations they talk about. You know, and it's a real problem. You have to understand populations in relationship to each other. So this oppression Olympic arguments is just, you know, it's covering. It's a way to actually mask the economic and racial privilege of groups without having to say that those groups are actual part of the system. You know, everybody wants to be advantaged and disadvantaged at the same time, despite the fact that that's not the way the world works.
Context of white supremacy, Dr. Tommy Curry. Speaking of policy change, I have heard a lot of folks, even presidential candidate Bernie Sanders has weighed in on this. Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, it's been a growing chorus of folks saying, hey, one policy change that we could make that would really benefit black people and compensate, meet some form of corrective for the war on drugs, legalization of cannabis. Do you think that that would be something that would be a benefit to black people? Why or why not?
Well, I'm actually kind of torn on this. I mean, I've been reading several stories where, I mean, I think actually in Colorado we were saying that the arrest for, you know, black and brown youth has gone up since the legalization of marijuana, right? I don't know. I think, you know, Michelle Alexander recently came out with a post saying that what this inevitably did was kind of codify the criminal status of black people who were incarcerated for drug crimes before the law was passed. And it gives now white people access because they could afford the licenses and they could afford all the proper things to actually make money off of something that's still used to criminalize poor minorities. So I don't know. I think two things. I think the legalization comes with a certain price, and I think that economically disadvantaged people don't necessarily have the means to afford the benefits or to obtain the benefits of that. I think on the other hand, what's more needed is decriminalization that reaches all the way back, so that if the state truly believes that it's not an offense to either sell, own, or use marijuana, then you need to decriminalize all the people that you said before were in fact dangerous to society because of it, right? And I think that that's what would actually benefit poor black and brown populations, especially black and brown men, more than putting a price tag and a licensing fee on obtaining and selling marijuana to the public.
That is number one. I'm in Washington State. It's one of the five areas that has legalized. It's been they voted in 2012 when President Obama was reelected. And I have not seen anywhere that has done anything close to what even suggested what you're talking about, doing some sort of retroactive retribution and say, hey, people, that if you were locked up or if you're incarcerated now or anything like that, that we're going to try and, you know, get this off your record. I have not heard anything like that in any of the states. I could be wrong. Maybe I missed the data, but I have not heard that. I guess in the second portion, I know there was an article in the Washington Post, I believe, within the last 10 days, where they said it's been 4 years since cannabis was legalized here in Washington State, and they said they still don't really have any definitive data on whether or not this has any significant impact on keeping black people from being incarcerated, which is a big part of the argument as to why this should be done, right? This will help keep some black people out of jail. That they still don't really have any definitive data on that. About the only piece of definitive data that they have thus far is that it makes cannabis way cheaper in Washington State. And they were not really sure if that was a good thing or not. They were weighing the pros and cons of that, but they said the data is very clear on that. No real room for argument. It makes it way cheaper. Does this actually keep black people out of jail? 4 years on, we're not sure. You'll have to check back later, and we can give you the data on that. I know some of the other folks that we've had on have said that they think that this is going to be another kind of racist con where they give a lot of lip service, that this is going to be a big aid to black people, but then at the end of the day, it's not really going to do anything to impact the number of black people that are incarcerated, and they have suspicions that with everything else that's been tampered with, if you want to think of the water in Flint or GMOs and that sort of thing, why would I think that you're also not going to tamper with the cannabis that is now going to be legal? Does any of that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. But, you know, again, this is what I'm saying. Like, you know, part of it is just we just don't know yet, right? You know, and I think that given the science, these types of things never usually benefit the poorest and the darkest of the population. So I don't see this as being any different. And I'm certainly willing to suggest that. I mean, we could certainly be wrong about that. But like you said, until we have the data, until we can actually see how this affects the people who are consuming and selling it on the street, right? Because I mean, if you don't have a license, it's still illegal. So these are the kinds of questions that, you know, really need to be dealt with. And that's why I think decriminalization in this case would be much better, because it breaks down the class barrier and it makes an argument for why people who were locked up previously shouldn't serve out all their sentences or should get credit for time already served, given that this is no longer seen to be a problem within the society. But that's a paradigmatic shift in terms of how we view punishment versus, you know, illegal substances or what was deemed illegal substances. Not necessarily that we now have state control production and selling commerce of those substances. So, you know, I mean, you know, societies change. They do different things. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is how do those changes affect the people that we know usually end up on the bottom of those decisions? So I think that's what is kind of a way to see right now.
Right on. You wrote a great piece. Wanted to share a segment from it. The piece is titled "This Nigger's Broken: Hypermasculinity, the Buck, and the Impossibility of Physical Disability in the Black Male Body." I was reminded, or even before I get to what prompted me to kind of bring this in, they have a new television show coming out with Mike Epps starring Uncle Buck. Mike Epps is a black actor. He is the character Uncle Buck. I was reminded of that. They've been calling black people bucks for a long time. It was not lost on me just having Uncle Buck on the screen and then a picture of a black male. I thought that was a significant amount of racist coding. At any rate, with your report, someone just put on my Facebook page today. Now, this happened in Paris, global system of white supremacy. There was a black male, triple amputee. He had lost both legs and one arm, and the police in Paris were molesting him, thought he was dangerous. They took his prosthetic limbs off I guess they were searching him. They thought he had a weapon or something dangerous that he was going to do. Took his prosthetic limbs off. He's sitting on the ground. It's multiple officers, not even like this is one person, and they go through this whole nasty interrogation process. They have video of this. It's on France 24. People want to check this out. Someone just put that on my Facebook page today, and it reminded me, if folks recall, kind of the end of 2015, D'Arcy Neal, this is a black male. He was on a United Airlines flight, and he did not get any assistance getting off the plane, and he ended up having to crawl. And they have video of this. He ended up having to crawl off the plane to get access to the bathroom. And then after this went viral, United Airlines came out and apologized, and we're so sorry, and, you know, we should have helped him. And they gave him like $300 or something tacky that was supposed to compensate for all of this. But this kind of gets to the point that you raised in this piece. Just to read a quick snippet before I get your response, you write, and this, you're referencing a different female. She's writing about her husband. The female is Nirmala Everless, I think is how you say her name. And she's talking about her black male husband who's disabled. And she, or you write, the concern she conveys for her husband, Robert, who was suffering with a grade 4 brain tumor, is a startling reminder of how the black male body is perceived as a danger regardless of its actual physical state. As a black male, I understand her relief when she tells the reader how lucky they both felt that most of Robert's seizures occurred in the privacy of their own home. I know her fear, the repetitive terror she experienced imagining her husband being shot or killed because the public did not know how to react to a black male body seizing. Averlez is correct. The black male body is a source of terror in white patriarchal society, and when transformed during a grand mal seizure with rolled back eyes, harsh grunting sounds, mouth drooling bloody foam, and the occasional loss of bodily function with its associated putrid smell, could become an even more terrifying spectacle as a result of how lethal triple combination of race, gender, and disability. But what conditions the maleness of the black disabled body? What is the role black man plays in Averlez's knowledge that to be perceived as a dangerous black man in the wrong place at the wrong time could result in death, and the public's fear that even a disabled black man is black and male enough to pose a threat? Great paragraph, I thought. Just kind of what informed and your motivation for addressing this, because I have not really heard too many people focus on disability and black people as it relates to racism, white supremacy.
Well, I did an interview with a philosopher that works on disability, Shelley Tremaine. And one of the things that I was saying, you know, again, you know, I'm constantly pushing for us to complicate how we look at black males, specifically them and how we, you know, them while they're living. You know, I think a lot of people conflate studying black men with just reporting the statistics of their death. You know, so when we talk about Trayvon, and I mean, really think about this. Anytime we ask people to speak about black men and boys, we do it when they're dead. So what was what does Trayvon Martin's dead body mean? What does Jordan Davis's dead body mean? What does Michael Brown's dead body mean? But, excuse me, we don't really have a chance to articulate the meaning and the circumstances of their living conditions. And what I mean by that is there is not a language or theoretical concept that articulates, you know, what Fanon called phobogenesis, or phobiogenesis with regard to the black male body. So what you see, what I was trying to articulate in that paragraph is like, listen, even when black men, when black males are in a situation where they are physically incapable of committing the types of crimes and violence that people imagine them to do, they're still perceived as if they're able-bodied enough to commit those crimes. Right? Think about it, right? This is, we're talking about situations where black men are in wheelchairs, where black men have been sometimes, you know, disabled by gunfire. They're not able to walk or run, but there's still this fundamental paranoia in the white imagination that this disabled body, maybe sometimes crippled body, is able to harm them in a way that
you know, that requires a kind of superhumanism, right? Like Michael Brown, you know, running through bullets, like they were bouncing off of his skin. We still imagine that kind of fantastic spectacle happening even with disabled black male bodies. And you ask yourself, why? Why is that the case? What is it in the imagination of white people and in the cultural transmissions of this society that have us believe something as fantastic as a person that's suffering from a brain tumor, that even their wife recognizes that an episode could mean that he would be shot on sight? And this is a very real issue, because, you know, what constantly happens in the academy is there's this fight for the battle recognition. Where, and I think I mentioned it before, where even though we now have more data about how many black people are actually killed, and you see that 290 to 300 plus black men are killed in society versus about 10 to 15 or 10 to 30 black women, they're saying, well, you can't focus on that number of people because it excludes people. And I have to, and I'm constantly asking myself, I was like, why does this not apply to any other group? Most things in the academy are written about white people. They're written by white people for white people. But nobody says that writing about a white man excludes a black woman. Writing about a white woman excludes a black woman. Right? Writing about a straight person excludes a gay person. It seems to only be about black males. So there, even in our very concept of black maleness, there is something that is dangerous and viscerally anti-human and seemingly anti-woman about their thought. And my position is that that is a huge internalization of what I call racist misandry, but also anti-black racism, that we think that even the very conceptualization of a being, that there's something naturally violent about it. So what I was trying to capture in that piece is just it's just so unbelievable that we can logically and consistently maintain that people that can't even control their own bodies, that are in many ways, that are not only disabled, but, you know, are immobile, somehow pose a social threat or a larger threat that corresponds to things like a criminal, a rapist, or a thug, right? So, you know, I think that piece particularly, I actually just got a letter today that piece was accepted with minor revisions. That piece in particular is really the first piece to be written in philosophy that tries to deal with black men and disability. Because throughout the piece, I actually talk about the perception of black men as rapists, and how even in To Kill a Mockingbird, there's this idea that even a disabled black man who was really forcibly sexually coerced by an able-bodied white woman they're deciding whether or not he is, in fact, a rapist. Never crosses their mind that he could be the victim of rape. Never crosses his mind that his disability prevents him from being a rapist. None of this becomes the basis of how we understand his body. The issue is being black and male overdetermines him in such a way that despite his physical disability, he is in fact still a rapist. So these kinds of things, I believe, are the foundational core of how we view black maleness in the society. And this is why I get a lot of pushback from, you know, feminist articulations of gender and gender theory. Generally, because unlike most people who say, well, there's a patriarchal society, hence all men benefit from it, my argument is this is a patriarchal society where racialized or subordinate males uniquely are disadvantaged by it. And I think when you look at history, I think when you look at the work of Jim Sidonias at Harvard, I think when you look at some of the other work by Prado and all these other people who are doing social dominance theory, and when you look history with some of the early black sociology work did in the 1950s and 60s, that you see a very real pattern where racially subordinate males are some of the most some of the most numerous victims of white supremacy and patriarchy, that they don't benefit from maleness in the ways that we traditionally think in liberal discourse or traditional gender theory. So that just adds another layer, how disabled, racialized male bodies, specifically black men, are still imagined as terrorists despite physically being incapable of being the terror that people see them as or perceive them as.
I wanted to read one more paragraph from this piece. Congratulations. Sure. On it being published. What was the term you used when you were talking about how the only time that you hear this kind of pushback, that if you're focusing specifically on black males and how they're impacted, that that's to the exclusion of black females, that you don't hear that applied when other groups are studied? I think you said racial sin. What was it? Racial.
I said racial misandry.
Racial misandry. Got it. Got it. Okay. The other paragraph that I wanted to read, and I'm glad you already brought up To Kill a Mockingbird. I think we've had English professors on this program before. Many of them have submitted that perhaps three of the most important novels in the history of American literature are Gone with the Wind, To Kill a Mockingbird, and Uncle Tom's Cabin, all three written by white women, all dealing with racism, white supremacy in various ways. We talked about that book, Harper Lee's book, on the program before, some of the great points that it brings out and what have you. I have consistently asked, isn't Atticus Finch racist? And people got upset and pushed back. I have been vindicated because the sequel that came out, yes, Atticus Finch is racist, and everybody got all set up about that too. But I have not heard anyone, until I read your piece, I had not heard anyone point out that Tom Robbins, the black male who's accused of rape, ultimately gets killed in the novel, that not only did he not rape this white woman he lied on, taking the crowd, this legal lynching, but that he was the victim of sexual abuse by this white woman. I've heard no one make that argument about this novel, even though it seems pretty clear that this could have been exactly what happened in the book. You write in this paragraph, this dynamic fundamentally challenges the supposed order and what was or was not imaginable in southern states during the 1930s. Even if the white public knew that Mayella, that's the white woman he's accused of raping, had sexually assaulted Mr. Robinson, their actions would have been no different. They intentionally preserved the order of the South. This was not a moral question. It was a decision to control the economic and political station of black people for economic and political gain. The disabled body of Tom Robinson simply conveys to the reader the dedication white Alabamians have to this order, not their ignorance of it. Great sentence. Stated differently, the white public is not closed-minded or ignorant of racism and epistemic friction. They are aware of social order and racial advantage. Medina's complete disregard for the historical power white women have exercised over black males results in an ill-formed theory that again erases the victimization of Mr. Tom Robinson specifically, but black males more generally. Historically, white women's sexual and political aspirations have been tied to an intricate but ignored exercise of racial and sexual violence against black men. During slavery, white women used rape to dominate black male slaves. These white women would coerce black men into prolonged sexual relationships, routinely raping them for their own sexual pleasure. Enslaved mulatto men were of particular interest to white women. As Thomas Foster notes in The Sexual Abuse of Black Men Under American Slavery, the sexual abuse of nearly white men could enable white women to enact radical fantasies of domination over white men with the knowledge that their victim's body was legally black and enslaved, subject to the woman's control. If their sexual exploits were ever discovered, they would simply appeal to the racist calculus, holding black men to be rapists and white women to be too pure and white to ever sexually desire a black male. While our present understanding of white womanhood sees them to be always sexually vulnerable to predatory black men within American slavery, white women of the planter class were certainly able to wield power over black men, although all white women could coerce enslaved black men given the legal and social setting in which they lived. Planter class women might more easily and more believably have persuaded the community to view them as innocent victims of their sexual contact with black men. I will pause there. I thought this was extremely important just because I rarely, and I would almost say never, hear anyone bring up, oh yeah, not just black females were being raped during slavery, black males were being raped as well. No one ever talks about that, and it's certainly no one ever talks about white women being capable of rape and this being something that was a routine practice under the system of white supremacy. In fact, I think the only mention that I've heard of this before is Martha Hoad's book, and I actually wrote her a few months ago to see if we could get her as a guest on the program. She said she didn't have time presently, but I'm going to ask again. Her book, White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century. Why is this such an ignored aspect of rape women, our inability to conceive of white women as rapist sexual abusers?
Yeah, I guess I wish I had the answer to that. I mean, you know, you'll find it's really interesting. Most of the pushback I get in the academy is about this concept of women as perpetrators of violence. And, you know, it's at this point, I mean, when you talk about white women, it's just so much work has already been done to kind of show. I mean, it hasn't been theoretically done. It's kind of been historically archived, like Martha Hoad's book, some of the work that's come out in the sexual relationships about white women and lynching, like Grace's book. You know, there's a new book by Melissa Stein that talks about the sexualization of black men next to white women. You know, so the work's been done that people can find out, like, oh, yes, this actually happened. You know, there's accounts of white women cutting off the genitals of black men who are lynched. So it would stand to reason that if you believe someone like Baldwin, that there's a homoeroticism involved with, you know, white men's fetish of black male genitalia, that at the very least there's some sort of sexual attraction or eroticism with white women doing the same thing. So I don't know why at an intellectual level people can't grasp that. At an ideological level, I think this is what happens when we've accepted certain tenets about white women that actually supports racism and white supremacy. Remember, a little earlier I was saying that we've bought into the idea that because we call white women minorities, that they're somehow equal to all the racialized groups in this country. That means that in that dynamic, we historically say things like, well, white men were the rapists, white men were the lynchers, white men were the perpetrators of racism, just because of a legal terminology that was introduced, you know, in the second executive order to include women in the Title VII and affirmative action in the 70s that disregards history. In other words, I'm saying that many of the ideas that we think are theoretical are really ideological in the sense that they just justify an already established order of anti-discrimination policies from the 1970s. And if you want to get specific about it, when you think about it, this is the same arguments that we get out of intersectionality, right? We care about race, class, gender, creed, religion, things of that sort, because these are the things listed in Title VII, right? So, you know, this is us using legal categories to read history instead of the other way around, which would be to use history to inform how we interpret certain policy or legal categories or even theoretical concepts generally. So in saying that, I think that what we've overlooked because of white women's legal, and I'm putting that in quotes, legal minority status, is that they very much participate in the same things that white men participated in. In fact, if you go back to the 1850s and 60s, when you look at some of these first suffragists and first wave feminists, if you prefer that terminology, these white women were not interested in questioning patriarchy, despite what people say today. These white women were very insistent that the home was their safeguard, and that they did not want to give up the kind of natural moral authority that comes with womanhood. After you get black people being free, you know, this is Melissa Stein's work. It's an excellent book called Measuring Manhood. She actually argues that the concept of gender was formulated around issues that white male scientists saw rising now that you had white women and free black men. So in other words, the concept of gender did not emerge around white women's interests or around womanhood. It actually evolved around free black manhood, because now that posed a threat to womanhood, and they had to theoretically and scientifically figure out what that threat was. If you take that reading of history, which is actually true, and you transfer it into something like what Louise Newman is talking about in The Origin of White Women's Rights, then you can see that the arguments and origins of feminism and white women's rights was not about them becoming equal to black men. It wasn't about them becoming equal in society generally. It was about them taking the reins of white supremacy. So if you read things historically, like the actual development of what white women were arguing for, then you see that most of the notions we have about white women's rights or white women's positionality in the United States has always been to be a greater part and handmaiden of white supremacy, never to act against it. And that means fundamentally that they were participating and supporting the notions of white patriarchy. One of the things we find in the 1890s, you can see this by people like Charlotte Gilman, is that you see white women wanting to come out the house, but in coming outside of the home, which was the safe barrier from the black male rapist, they wanted white men to make society
safer from them, which meant eliminating the black male rapists. So this is why around the Reconstruction and turn of the century, you have this huge increase of sexual oppression, this huge increase of lynches. So, you know, fast forward that to what we're talking about in, you know, in To Kill a Mockingbird in the paper, the issue just isn't the incidence of rape. The issue is how white women, because of their position as a colonial or a colonizer, or slave owner, or master, or any of the terms that you want to use that codifies that same kind of language, and the native male, that in all these kinds of historical relations, they functioned as the patriarch. Because the same kind of rape the white man would do to black men and black women. See, nobody even wants to talk about that homoerotic link, right, that white men also rape black men during slavery. That's the same tools of domination that white women use amongst the same populations. So if white women are in fact imitating or creating a certain kind of logics based on their gender and its relationship to Native men and women, then we have to consider that. And I think, honestly, one of the reasons that we have such a hard time with understanding white supremacy is because we keep reading it as a phallic extension of white male domination and not as a phallic extension of white women's desire and aspiration to actually rule and dominate the world next to white men. So when we attack white men, notice there's a reproductive aspect of white culture that's never attacked, namely, how is it that white men constantly get recreated and recodified with the same cultural aspirations and expectations? The last 40 years of cultural studies, the last 30 years of black studies, well, that may be, well, the 80s, yeah, so, you know, 20, 25 years of black studies has attacked white male patriarchy. It says nothing about the ways that white women interact and are culturally assimilated into white supremacy and what they, as the reproductive forces in white culture, teach children. So what I'm trying to do in my work is not just identify them as rapists, that's a big part of it, but also to show that the capacity that white women have historically is one of the unearthed aspects of white supremacy that we must pay attention to. The issue isn't to keep criticizing white men. White men have power. White men die out. We know that. They understood that since the Empire of the Mother in 1863. The real question is, how then does the race keep reproducing itself on the same basis? And that is a female principle. And that's what. And even if you look at the Academy, there are very few works that actually criticize white women, and practically no works, and this is the ironic part about it, despite people claiming their work in race and gender, there are practically no works that criticize white women for their role in racism and rape. What's happened is we've displaced criticisms of women in under the gender category under feminism, and that criticism largely revolves around inclusion and exclusion. In other words, it's been recodified into a post-integrationist logic where it says, oh, well, the problem with white women from the 1860 forward wasn't that they were raping or castrating black men or starting WKKK organizations or owning slaves, etc. The issue was their movements didn't include black women's interests. And that's just a paper-thin explanation of what feminism was actually up to from 1860 to the 1940s, much less the 1950s, if you want to go that far, right? But depending where you want to start second wave feminism from. So all this really accumulates in the fact that we don't have a real substantial knowledge of white women's actual actions within these time periods. And what we do is we say, well, since they're erased, we assume that everything they did was good and liberatory. And that's a naive reading of history. All right. I mean, I was really impressed with Crystal Feimster's work, Southern Horrors, because what she says is that one of the reasons that you don't see white women in these pictures of lynching is because they took them out. Right, so there was a deliberate effort by the white race. And given that knowledge, this makes perfect sense, because if womanhood is supposed to be the moral center of your race, you don't want to show it as barbaric. So you would take them out of the picture. But she's like, you know, people would still report them. There's other family photos that show them there, et cetera. So you got to think about it. There is a deliberate effort by white supremacy to remove white women and make them the kind of, you know, center of moral virtue and progressivism. So ask yourself, if this was such a patriarchal culture, why would they do that? Why would they be so invested in protecting the moral image of white women in a system that's supposed to be completely dominated by men? So that means that there's a separate interest, a racial interest in keeping that notion alive. And I think that that's something that we need to explore. The fact that they were present at lynchings, the fact that they practiced castration, the fact that they were rapists, you know, all this accumulates into a very rich history of how white womanhood is, if not identical to patriarchy, similar enough to have a separate matriarchal lineage that is just as barbaric, just as tyrannical, and just as historically wrong as the argument of patriarchy. Remember, because that the argument that we're making at best starts at the turn of the 1800s. It's not like people actually know what was going on in the 1780s, and they're saying that's American American patriarchy. Our notion of American patriarchy, at best, you know, starts in the mid-1850s. So if that's the case, then white feminism rises up with that exactly, right? Because that's when we see the birth of gender in America.
Wow. Incredibly important. I'm so glad within this conversation that we started off talking about Hillary Clinton at the beginning of this and her relationship with black people. Before I get callers, if folks have anything they would like to ask Dr. Curry, the number again, 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6. If you have a question, I was going to ask, since you kind of framed it, given the earlier time period during plantation era, antebellum period of the United States, in terms of white women and their sexual exploitation of black males, I was going to ask if you see this continuing. I mean, it's 2016. Do you see this dynamic today? But I thought the point that you raised kind of at the end of your response about how white women's participation in racism, white supremacy extends beyond just sexual exploitation of black males, that, you know, they are intricately involved with the reproduction of white supremacy. How do you see that happening, 2016, white women, in terms of what they're doing now to make sure that this system stays in place?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the biggest way that white women have perpetuated the system is just denial. You'd be surprised how many. I mean, I remember once I gave this. I gave a talk. I was on Rob Redding's show back when he was on Sirius XM, specifically about white womanhood. And I was saying that if you look at 19th century white female activity and turn of the century 20th activity, like in the WKKK, you see a direct extension of that into how white women position themselves politically during Obama. You know, during the Obama administration. And one of the comments I got based on that talk or that, you know, that clip was that I think that what you're saying perpetuates misogyny. And I asked the person who made the comment, I said, well, listen, I'm confused. This is a historical argument that simply links what white women factually did with what they're claiming they're possibly going to do under Obama. So you're telling me that to tell you facts about white women's tyranny perpetuates hate of white women. And they were like, yes. And when this person said this, I was like, you see, this is the problem under this liberal framework. The liberal framework that's largely informed, the progressivism that's informed by feminism, suggests that point blank, women are not perpetrators of violence. And that's an a priori thing. That means that in the very concept, if you're thinking of a woman, you have to say the concept of woman itself is good. And that's a huge problem, because if you believe even that concept, then that means that you can't ever read history correctly. So that means that any time that I read what white women did or what started feminism or any of their political issues or battles or, you know, anything, ultimately I say, well, those are all exceptions, because the rule is white women are generally good. Now, in the academy, this is the mantra. So, I mean, you know, I'm in philosophy. I've had arguments with people about all this stuff, and they just refuse to read the books. And mind you, these books are largely written by white women who are historians that have done work on, like, the suffrage movement or the mid-19th century feminist, things like that. And this is what they come up with. So they even reject work done by white women, since, you know, they never trust black males anyway. And so it means that there's a fundamental cultural block to accepting that white women commit racial violence. And this is taken up largely even in some of the discourses that we think are radical, like, you know, post-colonial thought, even black feminism. Because the argument is not that white women are tyrannical. The argument is white women are blind and exclusive. So that means that you never get to these fundamental issues that white women have had with the black male body. You switch the center, so to speak. So you say the issue isn't how white women treated and castrated and murdered black men. The issue is whether or not they've incorporated black women. And once you do that, it means that you've created a cast of womanhood, right? I mean, I've always said that I wanted to write an article criticizing progressive gender theory called Treat Me Like a White Woman, right? Because the concept of womanhood that's being circulated around still has a antithetical relationship to black maleness. So you get the myth of the black rapist coming out of Reconstruction, you know, when black men are getting freedom. The first thing you get out the 1960s when black men are pushing for freedom in the black power movement and civil rights is the myth of the black rapist. So how does it repeat itself almost 100 years later? And that's because of the codification of what it means to have a free or politically active black male. The idea is the domination of women. So if you keep that notion going, which is the mainstay interpretation of hegemonic masculinity, and you apply it to black males, then it means that any political action that black men do is going to be hegemonic. Hence, every black male who's politically active that's not a feminist or gender progressive or whatever identity politic label they assume will tend towards patriarchy. And that's why you get this same type of labeling floating around blogs, because this is the kind of logic they use. And during the whole time that you're attacking racialized black and brown men for being, you know, machoistic or patriarchal, you're excluding the fact that the most adamant demonstrations of a subordinate group taking power and using that power for genocidal or just heinous crimes and murder or sexual violence is white women, right? Because white men came out with power. White women got power, and then when they got the right to vote, when they got into the public, they decided to start lynching and killing and start Klan organizations. That's not what black people did. Black men didn't start the civil rights movement. Sure, we could argue about whether it was inclusive or exclusive and start sacrificing women in the public. That's not what happened. Now, sure, it was a different time in the 1960s and 70s, but you didn't get the kinds of lynchings and kinds of things that you got for white women in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And so the question to that would be why? What is it about this group? What is it about their marginalization? What is it about their techne that they tried to exercise politically that leads to the same things that white patriarchy led to? And that's a question that nobody wants to tackle.
Dr. Tommy Curry, Context of White Supremacy. We will nab folks who called in who have questions. Let's see. I believe this is our caller up in Canada. If you have questions for Dr. Curry, you should be with us. Feel free.
Hello, Gus. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Hey, Dr. Curry, big fan of your work, so I'm just going to go through
Thank
my
you.
Questions one by one. In regards to identity politics, this is something I've been dying to ask you. Since she came out with a book deal, Rachel Dolezal, and I remember the whole debate that happened with her and Caitlyn Jenner, like, you know, it's not fair to compare them. It's not fair to trans persons because Jenner is being honest and Dolezal is lying. Do you think this shows a problem with the way we're thinking about transgender theory or how we're dealing with race in the context of identity politics?
Right. I think two things. I think, one, it's a problem how we think of gender theory, right? So when we talk about transgender theory, I'm always confused because the notions that we have of gender in the United States in terms of male and female are not universal, right? So as a scholar, when I say, okay, someone's transitioned to another gender, you know, I have to be very clear that this is a schematic that they're using based on kind of white puritanical notions or white puritanical anthropology. So I think that's a political contingency, not like a conceptual one. It's based on how that society defines it. The latter question about a misunderstanding of race, I think that's exactly the problem. Because notice what we're doing. We're saying that a person has the free will to determine who they are, right? And we apply that logic to transgender persons as well. So if a person is born a male and decides to transition to female, the world is demanded based on their insistence that they are, in fact, a female, right? The same thing with Dolezal. Dolezal simply performed black femaleness. I remember when this first came out, I made the argument. I was like, could anyone imagine a white person trying to perform black masculinity? And if they did, would they want those life chances, right? I think that the question of race now being so diluted, because what we do is we take race as a concept, and then we problematize it with every other identity. So you take a bowl of race, and you drop in gender, and you drop in class, and you drop in religion, and you drop in region, and you drop in language, and then suddenly you get this whole huge dispersion of what blackness means. Everybody has blackness. It's all an interpretation. Those all just benefited from that intellectual moment that we're in right now. So we've programmed people in the last 20 years off the back of post-structuralism and really thin academic debates to accept that you don't want to define blackness biologically or culturally, that it's something that could be shared amongst everybody. But notice what that's flipped out, what that's now meant. Even though you say that people could transition to different genders, if you pick a gender, you think that that gender represents the standpoint from which you emerge. In other words, when you say something like, I'm a woman, in this country, that means that you have a politics, that you have a historical standpoint, that you've been a victim of patriarchy, right? These are actually things that Judith Butler argued against in her arguments about gender performativity, but nonetheless, that's what still stands. Nobody pollutes gender that way. In fact, you add on to it. So if you're a white woman, you get to say, I'm a victim of patriarchy. If you're a black woman, you get to say, I'm a victim of white supremacist patriarchy. If you're, you know, and you just keep going on and on. But if those locations remain stable, then what does it mean when you dilute the standpoint of people who are racial? And that means that so a racial Dozal is able to claim authority because no one can question a black woman about her identity. Right? It's like lemonade. Nobody who's not a black woman could comment on black women's art production. So now the effect of that is that to some it's empowering, right? Because now black women have something to insert epistemically into the world. They author it. It's before formal theory. It can't be checked, can't be questioned, it's experiential, et cetera. But then the flip side is, well, then when you get a Rachel Dolezal, you can't question her. You can't, because you created a situation and an experiential link that is beyond critique, you can't question her racial authenticity. And then when it comes out that she's white, because people are so diluted in terms of what they think race actually means or what effect it has on a person's personality or behaviors, people are still saying even though she's white, she can still be black. Now remember, we're 40, 50 years removed from if you had any drop of blackness in you and people knew about it, you were black. So we're moving from a time where any stain of black blood ruins your whiteness to a world where whiteness now can become blackness. And if that's the case, if discursive theories can undo histories of the one drop rule and anti-miscegenation laws, I think that black people, the black public, and black academics really need to think what they missed in such a short period of time. Because think about it, no other concept that we have known to man has been diluted that quickly, where there are actual laws in the books in the 1950s and 60s about miscegenation, intermarriage, etc., and you fast forward 40, 50 years, and suddenly people can just claim being that race if they want to. There's something wrong there. And notice it doesn't work the other way. So it's not like light-skinned black people who people know are black are getting to claim whiteness in that way. It's not like dark-skinned black people are able to claim other identities. So there's a particular power that this white woman had to transition in and out of blackness as she pleased.
Okay, thank you for that one. So now for my second question, because I've noticed that similar pattern, because I think especially when you start to study non-white cultures outside of modern contexts, and when we apply theories, just the sort of Eurocentric sort of idea. So it's something I noticed a lot more. Maybe it's easy. So now, second question. Now, in Toronto, we have a Black Lives Matter chapter, and I think I kind of blame you in the States because what we're seeing is right now, their focal point is, I guess, the two cases are two black males, Jermaine Carby, Andrew Loku, their murders by the Toronto police. And they emphasize intersectionality and argue about, you know, queer and trans theories. And they argue, you know, you can't just discuss race. You know, there are no single issues specifically. So consequently, it's been referred to in an article. This was written by a person of color, I believe South Asian person, but it wasn't a white person that wrote it, in case you're wondering. They've been called Toronto's most effective LGBTQ movement. And this is based on the leadership is black women, black queer, trans, non-gender conforming, and they have a intersectional emphasis. And what I find is they're not giving you a lot of various empirical data. They just keep saying that they have it worse because of multiple identities. So how is this framing as the most effective LGBTQ movement being led by, even though it's the focal point is black males, that's who their central thing is, but it's the most effective LGBTQ movement. How is this framing problematic in terms of when we're talking about intersectionality and this question, which I find very annoying, who leads?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, there's so much wrong with that. You know, I think basically if we look at it sociologically, we know that most police brutalities happen to racialized males. In this country, by rate, I mean, certainly not by number because white men outnumber, so they have the highest number, but by rate, black and brown males are shot the most, right, in proportion to women, which is, you know, 10, 20, right? That's not to say they're not important, but again, the magnitude, you have 200-300 racialized males shot. So then given that reality and the history, which shows that black men have been targeted for things like castration, lynching, police violence, et cetera, incarceration at astronomically higher rates, right? So in the United States, it's like 65,000 black women in prison, and, you know, for black men, it's like 864,000. I think it went down this year, so it's like 730,000, 50,000, something around that. So then you have to ask yourself, then what are they actually trying to do? They're trying to make an argument which says that you don't need to look, and this is what I mean when I say that we rely on a priori arguments. They try to say that what makes a person disadvantaged is how many disadvantaged identities they possess. And because maleness is not considered a disadvantaged identity, because they say we live in a patriarchal society, they say that the focus on black males itself is patriarchal. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem is that reasoning originates in an article on intersectional invisibility. What that article says is that androcentrism means that in patriarchal societies, males, because they're valued more than females, are attacked more for violence. The authors of that article also suggest that because males are attacked for more lethal forms of violence, that that's an example of male privilege. Now, their reasoning is because you're in a patriarchy where maleness is valued more, other males target other males, and that's an example of the power structure of male domination. And they want to interpret that as male privilege. That's silly. Right, because they're actually responding to subordinate dominant or social dominance theory, which argues that in patriarchal societies, patriarchy affects racial subordinate males more, because we could look at things like rates of discrimination, economic situations, and lethality, like the use of violence against them, as proof. So they want to reinterpret what that signal means. What intersectionality has done is it's come about and says, okay, there are two things that we're historically concerned about. One, the rise of the race man, right? So when you read Kimberly Crenshaw's, you know, first article about intersectional coalitions, she actually says that one of the reasons that we need intersectional coalitions is to prevent the rise of race men, which means that they don't want another emergence of black men leading political movements. And the second thing is that you have to look at how they interpret the calculus. So the calculus is going to say maleness is a privilege, and then you have the cases where maleness leads to more death. They're just going to say, well, even the deaths of all these lethal deaths of males, racialized males, is a privilege. Now, I personally find that morally deplorable, because what it means the theory has to do is suggest that even if maleness gives you more harsh consequences, like incarceration or you know, homicide by the police, or more rates of poverty or disease or a shorter lifespan, you have to say, well, that's still privilege. And the question I ask, you know, in my book, I have a whole section on this, and I ask, well, then what point do you get to determine what's genocidal or not? So if your argument, so basically you're suggesting, like in the case of Boko Haram, that because the women were taken, that's sexism. But because the men were killed, that doesn't matter because they're males, right? It means that the maleness category of black men, of brown men, becomes insignificant. And again, I think I mentioned this before. This is what I think Althea Matua points out, is that males in even these patriarchal – intersectionality fails because even males in patriarchal societies experience a kind of gendered sexism or gendered racism. And for you to – or racial sexism and gender racism – for you to ignore that means that what you basically do is say the kinds of violence that men experience are of no moral significance. And this is part of the language – or the calculus that's being taken up by some of the liberal pseudo – you know, pseudo-liberal, pseudo-intellectual, academic, Black Lives Matter activists who want to say we should decenter maleness, even though maleness is at the center of the violence.
So even that identity politic violates their standpoint epistemology, which is the groups who are most affected by social situations and circumstances are best positioned to articulate what those circumstances and relations are. Black men are overwhelmingly more affected by incarceration and homicide and police brutality in this country than practically any other group, yet they deprive them of that standpoint, right? And I think that if we're going to seriously challenge these kinds of blind spots, then we're going to have people and scholars who are willing to criticize intersectionality and some of these neoliberal aspects of black feminism. But as you know, you probably know, be it on social media or in the academy, that's a faux pas. You can't criticize, you know, these kind of gender ideas, especially as a male, because they'll just call you patriarchal or mansplainer or some other thing. But again, this is why I think somebody like Adolf Reed is so important, is he's showing that the reason that those things come up, like patriarchy and mansplaining in those contexts, is because identity politics protects a certain class dynamic. These are not poor working class black women. These are not poor working class black men that are being centered in these discussions. This is a bourgeois conversation that believes they have the power to decide which black people are recognized and which black people are not recognized. And as Franklin E. Franklin Frazier always tells us, we have to be very, very suspicious of the ways that the black bourgeoisie reproduces knowledge and aligns itself with other white supremacist interests. So I think that in many ways, Black Lives Matter is an extension of the dehumanization of black men, not a remedy to it.
Do you have a final question, caller in Canada?
Okay, my final question. Do you think, and this is, I'm just going to be crazy about this, do you think Trump, the way that he is, the whole white nationalist sentiment, that could actually be a wake-up call for regular people to be more engaged to talking about racism? Because I found that, do you think he could basically be a wake-up call? Not what you want, kind of like that, what Malcolm X used to say about certain white politicians, that they're better than white liberals because at least, you know, they'll wake people up. That kind of sentiment. Do you see where I'm going?
Like the Melanie Price argument, that things get worse, bad enough around race, and it wakes up black people to become more nationalistic and conscious of it.
Yes, yeah, so they are.
Yeah.
Do you think that's possible with Trump in this day and age? Or?
To be honest with you, I mean, I've thought about this as well. I think there are two cases. I think on the one hand, no, because you have so much class division that, you know, the way that people perceive what's actually happening with Trump is so dispersed that I don't know it would lead to racial solidarity. But then I want to say that, okay, let's imagine that it does happen. Majority of the black people in this country are economically impoverished and politically disenfranchised. So that means that even if they woke up, what does that lead to? Right? Like, in a world of criminalization where the police kills people for walking across the street, we know that mass protests by poor black people are probably not going to work. Political reform is not going to work because these people don't have access to the political system per se, and certainly not in a normative sense where they can pass laws, put in representatives, etc. And then you still have to mediate that, even if that's true, what do you do about the black people? Because there's certainly going to be black people that benefit if Trump wins. What do you do about that class of black people who are disowning the idea that racism's at the center, right? Because imagine if Trump gets elected and puts a whole bunch of black people, you know, on boards and gives them government contracts, etc., he's going to at least push back amongst the black bourgeois on the race issue. So the question becomes, how do people who are marginalized and largely voiceless overturn even the kind of symbolism or like the avant-garde representative class of Trumpism that suggests that, hey, this isn't racism, this is just class, and if you pulled yourself up too, you could succeed within this world. So I think after Obama, it's going to be harder, not easier, to articulate kind of the structural similarities of race and racism. Precisely because I think that you're going to have different classes of black people that are going to benefit in different ways from someone like Trump. And I think poor working class black people, as is usually the case, are going to be silenced, ignored, and pathologized, which is exactly what you see happening even in Black Lives Matter. So when poor working class black people are saying, or even black men are saying, we should lead, you have bourgeois educated black folk, men and women, saying you can't because you're patriarchal. And that doesn't resonate to working class, poor, uneducated black people, right? It's a bourgeois argument, because working class black people are like, we work, we experience vulnerabilities. The language of patriarchy and male dominance doesn't exist in our culture the ways that, you know, it does in normative, in bourgeois white, middle class white culture, right? These are not anthropological formulations built on the experience of working class black people. These are white terms that you impose on them. So, you know, I don't think there's going to be a shared language that causes the kind of class revolts or the kind of nationalistic coalescence around these issues as there were, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Appreciate that, caller in Canada. I think this is Thomas in New York. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Kerr? You should be with us.
Yes, I do. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Good evening, Dr. Curry. Good evening, Gus. And the way you broke down that that white woman thing, man, that was amazing. It seems like under a system of maybe both white patriarchy and matriarchy at the same time. I mean, it's crazy. My question for you, I'll just stick to this one question here. Do you think that based off of the negative connotations that come with the word black, that it's a good idea for black people to consider themselves to be black, based off of the definition, the synonyms of the word, where white means great, good, you know, pure, black means evil, dark, death. Do you think for us to keep calling ourselves black people, it's a good idea? And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Well, I think, I actually prefer the term black over African American, but that's largely because I do work in 19th century ethnology, so that I wasn't very keen on what the term African American meant. It meant Afro Americans were more civilized Negroes from barbaric Africans, you know, who were Negroid, and so I didn't like that term. So I prefer black, and I think it also has political significance in the sense that, you know, white people have thought every term that black people have called themselves has been negative, you know, be it colored, be it African-American, you know, the thing with African-American, well, you're saying you're not a real American, you're splitting yourself off, this is anti-patriotic, you know, patriotic. When it was Negro, you know, of course, Negroes are lazy, they're manipulative, they're less intelligent. When it was colored, you know, they're untrustworthy, right? Because all these things, the names that black people, the reactions that white people have to black people is not just the name. It's the political and social circumstances surrounding that name. It's the why, you know, watermelon or economic, you know, entrepreneurship. Like these, all these things became dangerous in a world where black people were trying to sustain themselves economically. One of the reasons that, you know, black men with guns become so scary is not because black men have historically been dangerous. White men and white women have been vastly more dangerous historically than that, but it's the symbolism of fear. And that symbolism of fear of black people being armed, fighting for their rights, starting all the way back from T. Thomas Fortune and Douglas to Ida B. Wells to Robert F. Williams, and then, of course, to the symbol that most of us share, which is the Panthers, this kind of imagery inspires fear. And when you have black academics that internalize that, right, they're like, oh, the Black Panthers were patriotic, et cetera. It's like, but black women had guns in the 1880s, and they were going to pose with black men. I'm confused, right? And a black woman wrote that, you know, Elsa Barkley Brown. So if we value the negations of our own personhood based on words without understanding the social circumstances that have kind of contoured and informed them, then we're going to be in a perpetual search for a label, brother, because white people are going to, no matter what we call ourselves, white people will find a reason to denigrate that identity as well as our people. That's just the kind of reality that we live in.
Answered your question, Thomas, in New York? No, he said he was going to mute his line.
So, yes, I was muted. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a great answer, and I'll ponder on it. And thank you very much for taking my call, guys.
No, I appreciate the question, brother. Thank you.
For sure. Let's see. Roz in – well, just Roz. Sorry about that. Roz, you should be with us. Do you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Well, yes, greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Dr. Curry. I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Tonight is incredible. You're one of my favorite guests. And
thank
the first thing – yeah, you're really a special brother, and I appreciate you. I wanted to ask first, what's the title of your new book, and what are any titles of your other books that you've written? Because I would like to get my hands on them.
Well, thank you. The title of the book that I've written is called The Man Not. It's actually under review right now, so hopefully, if the reviewers, give it good reviews, it'll be out sometime in 2017. The other book that I've written is on William H. Ferris. It'll actually be out in July. It's called, it's a republication of The African Abroad. And I'm currently working on two other projects that I hope will either be out in 2017 or 2018. One of them is called The Mismeasures of Manhood, which is a book on the history of the development of the concept of black masculinity from the 1900s to the 20th century. And the other is a book called Illuminated in Black. It's a book on Derrick Bell. I promised him before he died that I was going to write the first book on his philosophy. So I'm almost finished with that. But the two books, the one on Ferris, and hopefully the one on The Man Not, will be out within the next year.
All right. And is there like a website where we can where I can maybe track the progress of the developments of these works? I would really like to get
absolutely, because I post a lot of chapters. If you just Google my name, mm-hmm. or like Google, you know, Tommy J. Curry and black males or Tommy J. Curry and racism, it'll take you to my academia.edu account.
Okay.
And I publish, I mean, practically everything. So like the piece that Gus was reading from, This Nigger's Broken on Disability and Black Men's up there. The piece that I just wrote about black men and rape, the eschatological dilemmas, is up there. So all those pieces are actually up there and available for you to download for free at your will.
I greatly appreciate that. Now, I have two questions about tonight's discussion.
Yes, sir.
Because this discussion really kept my mind turning. The first question is, earlier you spoke about black leaders focusing on the goodwill of whites in order to make headway towards equality. Would you say that black people have been conditioned to seek white validation to the point where that seems to be the most prominent approach we take to dealing with white supremacy? And how do you feel about that?
I think it happens at a few different levels. One of the things that I've really enjoyed about Lewis Gordon's work on disciplinary decadence is that he writes a snippet where he talks about black people who write scholarship and theory for the recognition of white people. And he says that what that does is it pulls black thinking into the kind of decadent thinking of how white people have already formulated knowledge. And I think that that could also analogously extend into how we think of politics. One of the ways that we think of political action in this country is that we base it on whether or not white people recognize our personhood, recognize our rights, kind of recognize our experience and positionality. And I think that when we do that, we leave ourselves extremely vulnerable to whether or not they accept it. So I'll give you an example of that. You know, when we say that we were happy that we got Title VII, when we were happy that we got affirmative action, this is a recognition of racism. The next thing that happened under Reagan was they pulled it back. The same time we said that we were happy about multiculturalism, there was a pushback on conservatism saying that this destroyed knowledge, right? There was an attack against the leftist, you know, identity politics of the academy, right? When we got Obama, people pushed back and said, well, we think people are moving too far. Obama's splitting the country, right? All these notions of how we want to be recognized as equals to white people assume a context that assumes that structural, institutional, and legal structures are not set up to never let black people become equal. Now, think about that. What other group of people have been as devastated by unemployment and underemployment, lack of education? Even when our sisters get education and bachelor degrees, they don't find employment that's equal to what the level of education they have. Black men can't even find employment, right? Incarceration, all these things, right? So what is it that white people actually see? If we believe fundamentally that the path to equality is recognition, then what is it that white people see 50 years after the civil rights movement? Because they don't see the same kind of mobility that they believe that they've achieved through their own hard work. So does that recognition actually lead to them recognizing our humanity, or is it a pathologization of what they see blackness as? And in many ways, it's the latter, because what white people recognize is danger, is fear, is crime, is social problems, right, is the undesirability of the black population. So now we have to say, okay, well, if we based all of our hopes, all of our social and political mobility on the fact that white people recognize something in us or see a humanity, and when we come back, we see that they still hold these tropes about criminality, rape, right, moral degradation, then that can't be our strategy. So that means that we have to turn the lens backwards, and we have to say, okay, then what's wrong with us seeking recognition from people who can't demonstrate the very basic quality of humanity itself? In other words, why are we asking to be recognized based on our humanity when the white race in America certainly is not reflected? They have a capacity to even understand what humanity is, right? Because the kinds of cruelties that we see going on, the insensitivity to poverty, they let their own people die. They kill their own poor. They'll deny resources to their own people if they don't meet the standard of whiteness that they want. That was Occupy Wall Street. We are part of whiteness. No, you're not. You're losing homes, and now you're like them. So what makes us think that if they can't get through the class and the religious divisions amongst their own people, that they could overcome something that's historically rooted in our society that goes from slavery to neo-slavery to Jim Crow to the prison industrial complex and the super predator mythology specifically surrounding black males? What makes us believe that they could recognize anything but what they've already created us to be? Right? And I think that's the problem with the notions of recognition and the politics of liberalism that we've conditioned the black public and the black, you know, and I mean, you know, you kind of see these pseudo publics around like Facebook and Twitter. That's what we've conditioned them to accept uncritically. Right? I think this is why someone like Adolf Reed, but you can't, you know, because he's super leftist with his class politics. But I think this is why someone like Adolf Reed next to someone like a Derrick Bell meshes nicely with how we have to start finding kind of the middle ground of how we want to structurally analyze white people. Because that's the task, right? The task isn't try to reproduce ourselves or rectify ourselves so they see us better. The task is trying to figure out for black people and educating black people, not to change white people, what's wrong with them. And I think that that's what we've lost. We've reduced everything to this concept of whiteness. We're like, oh, you know, get past your whiteness so you can see me as equal, without saying what does it mean for white people to hold on to a view that they're superior to you and then use that notion of superiority to believe that they have the power to offer the world. Right? And I think that's what's impactful about, you know, Gordon's theory of decadence is that he's saying if you seek theory to be recognized by whites, then there's a certain level of authorial control that you give over to them. And we see this politically, too. We'll sell out we see this in the Academy all the time. We won't speak about poor black people in such a way that offends the disciplinary boundaries of our fields, like philosophy. You know, people aren't writing about violent revolution. We're writing about conversation. We're writing about intersectional recognition and coalitions because those are the things that appeal to white liberals. It's not because they're true. Most of the evidence that we have in economics and sociology show the exact opposite. They're not true. But the recognition of white people, that's what triggers the career. If white people like what you write, it doesn't matter if it's true or good. It's what white people like. So that advances you. If you write things that white people are not threatened by, that's what makes your name safe. But then that also comes with a choice. If I have my thoughts dictated by the people that I fundamentally believe are my oppressors, then am I actually perpetuating or propagating oppression, or am I just simply a pawn in white supremacy? Right? And these are choices that I think scholars have to make. You know, we talk about revolutions all the time because that's kind of the catchphrase in the academy. But if you're not actually writing things for a public that doesn't exist yet, because if you already accept that your public is brain dead or blind, right, to these kind of messages, you have to write beyond your present. And most people don't have the courage to do that. So I think recognition, you know, functions both at the level of what we write and produce, as well as the level of what we're trying to accomplish and through whom we're trying to accomplish it.
Wow, brilliant. Thank you so much. And let me get to my last question. I was going to say if your throat's irritated or if you have a cough, ginger would be very good for that. If you can suck on fresh ginger and then also make some ginger tea, it'll get rid of that for you fairly quickly.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem. And my question is, with your treatise on white women earlier was just great, and I just wanted to say with the insidious nature of white women, their past and current rape of black males and females, because I consider so-called interracial relationships today modern rape relationships just based on the imbalance in power. Would you say that white women are the origin and orchestrator of racism, white supremacy, due to the mother being the first teacher of the children? And, of course, it seems like just in your explanation, she has taken a back seat as a puppet master and placed the white male to the forefront as the example of what racism, white supremacy is, which is why she tends to get away with what she has for so long.
No, I think there's an argument to suggest that white matriarchy is at the center of patriarchy. I think the notion, like in my book, I talk about the empire of the home and how that extends into society, specifically during Reconstruction. So I think that if we're talking about this like factually, like historically, patriarchy evolved the way it did to protect white women. Right? And I, again, this is why I really like, you know, Sadonis's work and social dominance theorists, because they actually say, look, the stereotypes you have of rape and of black male criminality really emerge from the idea that patriarchy was the enforcement of white will and violence against black males to protect white women. And I mean, there's this story in, with Negroes with Guns, where Robert F. Williams says that white men used to at least take one white woman with them when they went out, you know, nigger hunting, because the white woman showed to the world the symbol of protection. So you got to think about that. White men didn't have to bring a white woman. They control everything. They could do whatever they want. But they still brought a white woman along when they wanted to lynch a black man just to say that the black man threatened her and they were protecting white womanhood. So you see a symbiotic relationship between white masculinity and white femininity that's not articulated by our gendered understandings of feminism and patriarchy, right? Feminism and femininity have historically informed and regenerated the rationalization and the gender logics of patriarchy. It's only very recently that it's decided to try to extricate itself from that. But notice, it extricates itself from patriarchy while embracing the fundamental tenets of capitalism, neoliberalism, specifically based on the notion of homo economicus, or economically interested, you know, the self-interest of the human, or the economic interest of the human, and its relationship to the rest of the groups. So think about it. The white woman's relationship to other minority groups is very similar to the white man's, because they get all the resources, they get all the jobs. You know, I mean, even at my university, most of the minority fellowships go to white women. So they get to, so if white men rule the majority position in terms of domination, then the benevolent position that is supposed to be caring and benefiting the underrepresented benefits white women. So yet again, they still emerge as both the two most powerful groups in the country, if not the world, because the very notions that you created to help minorities, you gave to the racial woman who's always been second fiddle to you, and it's a way for you to hide behind a language and have a rationalization that says that you care about minorities, but it just increases the wealth of the white race. You know, these are very specific systems.
Thank you very much for taking my call, guys. And thank you very much, Dr. Curry. You have a great evening and take care of yourself.
No, thank you, sir.
For sure.
Thank you.
The caller at 5992, last four digits, 5992. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Yes. Hello, everyone. Hello, Dennis.
Greetings.
Hello, Dr. Curry. And it's a pleasure, Dr. Curry, to be talking to you this evening. I just have a couple comments that I would like you to
address. Sure.
Okay.
Your phone's a little low. Could you speak a little louder, please?
I'm trying to. One of my earplugs doesn't work. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Amos Wilson, when he talked about the ABCs of oppression and genocide, he informed us that education is not about jobs. He said the primary reason is to advance the interests of a group of people and to protect the interests and secure their survival. Being a college professor in philosophy, would you comment on that, please?
Say that last part again, ma'am.
Okay. You said the primary reason for education is to advance the interests of a group of people and to protect the interests and secure their survival.
Yes. Now, I think that's completely true. You know, education. There's two things that I think happen when you look at, you know, progressive education theory, like at the turn of the century. One is that it becomes a way to improve the lot for white people by solidifying or giving kind of cultural solidarity around Americanness. You see this in Dewey. You see this in, you know, turn of the century progressive. Thomas Fallows writes a really, really good book on this. So that's one thing. The other thing, though, is that education also creates a certain kind of class barrier to social transformation. And this is what I mean, that when rich people think of education, it's a way for them simply to have a certification do what their class already suggested they would do. When poor people get education, or people outside of that class get education, they aspire to be part of that class. So in other words, what we have in the university, or what we have through schools generally, is people who aspire to be part of the middle class or the rich or the upper classes, And in that aspiration, they want to leave behind the poor people. They want to leave behind the underclass. So that means that they're situated in such a way that what they're trying to achieve can never be overthrown by what the realities they actually see. So they're not going to be people that want to burn down society. They're not going to burn down the state. They're not going to topple the university because they depend on the certification and authority of the university to get the kinds of jobs that separate them from the underclass. And that's the paradox, right? That's what George Jackson says in Blood of My Eyes, that the university, as much as it pretends to be this equalizing force in society, is really just the factory that mass produces people that aim to serve the state, right, or the society at large. He was speaking in the state, but, you know, I think it still holds. So given that reality, then we have to ask ourselves, then what are we trying to do with education? Because you got to admit, like, you know, academics are not really a radical bunch, right? These are not people that immerse themselves in the problems of society. Most of them don't even like facts, you know, as hard as that is to believe, you know. So I think I think Wilson is right in this instance, that when you look at education, this is to perpetuate the ideological and cultural interest of the people in charge, and more than often, that's rich white people, you know.
Okay, thank you. And I just have one comment about Donald Trump.
Yes, ma'am.
When I listen to Donald Trump, I see a free white man, unlike I've never seen. We can look at politicians in the Congress, and we can look at CEOs and other men in high stature, but they are not free. What I mean by that, they can't just say anything they want. They can't slander whoever they want and be in public so the world can hear them. So, you know, you being a philosopher, can you just, like, expound on the free white man as I see Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, I think his class position, his economic position certainly gives him more latitude, but I think freedom is relative. So, I mean, people like George Zimmerman or, you know, the guy who killed Jordan Davis. I mean, there's a lot of ways that white people who are economically deprived try to, you know, exercise freedom in, you know, killing or challenging black people. I think what Trump is doing, though, is a little different. I think what Trump wants to do is not just exercise, you know, kind of the old kind of notion of liberty, where you have the freedom to, you know, enact your will. But what he actually wants to do is he has a vision of creating a world that is so racist and xenophobic that only the people who are fundamentally interested in empire could buy into it. And I don't know if that's freedom as much as it is kind of propaganda and dictatorship. I mean, when you think about him, he's almost like a fascist. He's, because he believes in a national identity that's so strong and ethnocentric that it overwhelms, right, basically the Constitution. So, I mean, I think fascism is probably a better word for him. I just think he's a fascist. I don't know if it's really an exercise of freedom or positive or negative liberty in that sense. He has a vision for the geographical and cultural expansion of America, both in terms of its soft power, what America means to other countries, as well as its hard power. And then he has this kind of view of globalization and corporatism that seems to be very, very dangerous. It seems to be a notion where corporations not only supersede law, but they control law because they buy up everything. And when I heard him speaking about how he creates jobs and how he would destroy other countries' markets, this seems to be more of a modern, I don't even want to call it modern, a neoliberal fascist regime, one that's going to control economics and corporatism to push the image of America as both a superpower and exceptional and triumphant geography. And given that, I don't know, right? I don't think we've seen something like that in the 20th or 21st century. So that's, I mean, it's going to be interesting. We haven't seen it in America. I think we've seen it in Europe, but I don't think we've seen it in America. So, I mean, it's going to be, it'll at least be interesting for political scientists, but I think for the on the practical ground, it's going to be very, very difficult for black and brown people and poor, even poor white people to actually sustain themselves under his reign. I think it's going to be very chaotic.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate that.
The caller at, let's see, 7451, 7451. Do you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. So basically, the benign neglect is vivid in all aspects of human activity.
Sure.
I've noted time after time, you know, other existing issues are viewed and way heavier than racism, always results in, you know, an overcast of racism. And it seems like they have a built-in control in their behavior. Now, since we know our current situation and systematic range of challenges, what are your thoughts, Dr. Curry, on how we can economically empower ourselves as a group, politically and socioeconomically?
Wow, that's a great question. That, you know, I'm always somebody that concedes my limit of knowledge on certain topics. I think an economist would be better suited for that. But briefly, I can say two or three things that I think would certainly help. One is, you know, we need blocks and zones of investment and economic opportunity, meaning that we have to kind of buy up our own neighborhoods. We have to own the property. We got to try to circulate our own money. I think one of the problems that we have today, especially in terms of education, this is what I'm constantly talking to black students about, is here, since it's conservative, they have this notion of, you know, being entrepreneurs and owning their own businesses, and that's fine. But the people they want to serve are white people. So, in other words, we have a group of black people who are being educated and trained to aspire to be middle class, but they don't see themselves as improving a lot of their own people. They see middle class as being synonymous with integrating with white people in white neighborhoods and then white people as your clientele. Now, the problem with that is that it means that you don't get any social mobility, and black people uniquely don't benefit from educating black people because those people are constantly leaving our communities, leaving the neighborhoods, and not, you know, inspiring change or circulating revenue in our, you know, amongst ourselves. So I think that expectation needs to change. The other thing is, I think we need to focus more on economics. And here's what I mean about this, is that we need to start having conversations. Instead of constantly being, you know, bombarded by people with degrees in English and interdisciplinary studies, et cetera, we need to actually have conversations amongst political scientists, urban planners, and economists. And these need to be some of the people that we bring on to have commentaries about race in America. I remember not too long ago, maybe last year, I got into an argument on Twitter with Roland Martin. And I told him, I was like, all these black males are dying, but the people that you're bringing to talk about them are historians, are, you know, theologians, et cetera. I was like, if you're going to talk about black men or boys, why not speak about people who actually study black men and boys? Right, I think the same thing needs to happen in the when we talk about black people in economics and policy. We need to bring in people that have, you know, MPAs, degrees in public administration, people who are economists, et cetera, and we need to start hashing some of these things out with people who are culture critics and say, listen, what does it mean for black people to actually start a notion of, you know, economic development in some of these neighborhoods or some of these urban areas? Like, what would it mean? What would an economic development plan look like in Chicago, a place that's saturated with gun violence and homicide, right? To do that, we got to get urban planners that understand Chicago. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's, I mean, but see, that requires us admitting that theory's not going to fix everything, right? And I don't think that a lot of people are willing to do that, certainly not a lot of the people that we've selected to be our spokespersons. They're not going to say that my theory or my ideology isn't going to tell us how to start businesses in these kinds of, you know, urban zones. And I think we actually need to start talking to those people on programs like this, or, you know, it just in general, you know, about, you know, like in Ebony, right? Because, you know, all these black outlets need to start talking to social scientists, political science, urban planners, and economists about what's the best way to revitalize some of these places. I think that at the level in terms of what I do and historically and based on the structures that I examine, we need to recondition how we think about clientele and about how we use college degrees to improve or, you know, change the social circumstances of black people, black and brown people. Because what I find is that most of us want to transcend the conditions that we come from. We largely don't want to go back to it. And that's a problem. That means that we have to recondition a whole generation of people, if not two or three, in terms of what they think a college degree is used for.
Right. And, you know, I've always, you know, wondered, you know, with the whole initiative of, you know, individuals and families that, you know, grew up, you know, in a lower poverty, you know, environment, such as, you know, growing up in the hood and wanting to move out the hood. After moving out the hood and, you know, acquiring some, you know, levels of income, you know, would it be bad for them to think about trying to acquire land in the hood. So pretty much trying to, you know, improve the economic situation in the hood with other groups of black people.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, these are things that we got to talk about. I mean, this is stuff that we got to talk about with social workers. We need to have this conversation with sociologists. We need to have this conversation with clinicians. I mean, the power of being in the academy or even being, you know, a critic, the power that should have is that it gives you an opportunity to create criticisms and ideas that can bring certain people together. But what happens when you're a black public intellectual is that it's like a small stage. You keep trying to push everybody off. You're not interested in creating organizational foundations of knowledge or schools of thought. You know, that's what I constantly work on. Like, how are we creating different schools of thought? You know, trying to introduce and solve problems in our communities, because that's not what's rewarded. White people don't care if you're doing that. White people care whether or not you're telling them that they're good people. You know, I mean, I'm honestly like, that's what sells. If you come up and say, look, we need to get rid of race and we need to get rid of our black identity, we're all Americans, people like, they love that stuff, right? It fits with their idea. You come in and give tons of statistics about why racism still exists. Well, you know, this is bullshit. It's all ideological. You know, I'm like, okay. You know, but this is the world we live in. So to have a conversation about revitalizing communities and creating economic bases run by black people, I mean, that's a whole different level of conversation that I think is very valuable, but one that's not likely to be taken up seriously by scholars for some time.
Right. You know, what you said about the education institution being a factory painting of false equality mechanism is true, and the adverse effect that it has on our people, especially those in the lower class, that definitely deserves a DJ Clue bond. Now, my last question here is, I have noticed, you know, politicians, you know, when they have to go ahead and initiate the campaign, you know, they go to different, you know, black medias and, you know, they have these interviews with people such as Roland Martin, Breakfast Club, whoever the case may be. My question is there some type of agreement that takes place prior to the interview that basically suggests that these interviewers cannot ask any economic questions? Because
I'm sure there are.
Because it seems like, you know, we will talk about nonsensical stuff. We'll go ahead and do whatever type of dance is being popular. Whatever type of dance is popular, is Nae Nae or Dabs or whatever it may be. But when it comes to talking about what they're actually going to do for, you know, for black people as a group, it seems like that's not addressed. And, you know, my reason behind that is there a possibility that we don't have, you know, a group that represents us, not just from a voting perspective, also from a monetary perspective? Because, you know, we see the LGBT group, you know, they have, you know, a coalition that provides X amount of votes and also, you know, provides, you know, some type of super PAC or some type of funding to these politicians. So ideally, you know, they have an initiative that's geared towards, you know, either buying out these politicians or ranting them. So is there some type of, you know, agreement that takes place before the interview starts on camera that consists of, you know, our black media interviewers not asking specific critical economic questions in regards to, you know, blacks and, you know, all kinds of from a racism standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, this is the best guess, but I would say yes, right? Because, I mean, I find it almost impossible that venues like The Breakfast Club, or was it Hot 107, whenever Charlamagne was looking at, you know, Hillary Clinton crazy because she said that she carried hot sauce in her purse. You know, I mean, I find it almost embarrassing that you would have kind of a station or, you know, a broadcast like that that serves so many black people that wouldn't even bother to ask her one serious question about her campaign, right? And, you know, I think places like, you know, I think Pascal Robert and Yvette Carnell have certainly brought this out more publicly than most. But this is embarrassing. This is buffoonery that you would have a presidential candidate come up and talk to you about hot sauce and dancing to Beyonce, rather than questions about how does your policy materially affect the black community. And again, this is what I'm saying. This is the era of identity politics. I mean, this, when people write about us 50 or 100 years from now, this is not going to be the highlight of black intellectualism, right? Both the black scholar and the black public are going to be looked at as suspect because of the ways that we are trying to articulate both our political whims through, you know, things like Lemonade and how we understand what we believe to be policy. You know, Black Lives Matter is an organization that was talking about changing people's minds, and it took a white woman to say, you're not going to change people's minds, you need policy, right? So think about it. We're living in a world where the notion of privilege has more impact and cultural significance than the idea of a right, you know? And, I mean, that's what I'm saying. These are very, very, very dangerous and confusing times for young people growing up under this kind of ideological barrier, where they're more willing to have conversations with you about your identity and you recognizing them than whether or not certain practices in the society are fundamentally violating their human and constitutional rights. And this, I don't know what to say. So, I mean, I think that the fact that Hillary Clinton is not getting questions about economics, that she's not getting questions about quality of life, that she's not really getting pushed on mass incarceration when she comes on these black shows speaking to a black community that's been devastated by it, is representative of the types of ideas that we have about her, both her as a white woman and her as a Democrat, as well as what we take to be the central issues. We're not interested in what materially affects our community as much as we are about whether or not a person relates to us. And I think that's a sad state of affairs for us.
The person at 9828, did you have a question for Dr. Kurt? You should be with us.
Yes, could I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Dr. Curry, I do notice that in the African-American community that there are male chauvinists and, you know, quote-unquote male chauvinists.
Could you tell me what you mean by that term, sir?
Well, I say quote-unquote male chauvinist, meaning when I use the term male chauvinist, it's someone who they have already set agenda on what a woman's supposed to be.
Sure.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They have, you know, some guys, they might, well, you know, my woman don't post to wear makeup, you know, or she don't post to dress like this. All these women are... A lot of dudes say, I'm going to just use an example. All these women are gold diggers, right?
Okay.
Now, I can understand where they're coming from. You see what I'm saying? Because, like, someone was having that conversation earlier, and I just interject. I said, well, you're acting as if all women try to get into relationships, and one of the checkpoints is financial security. You see what I'm saying? And even though he was being male chauvinistic by slandering them all as gold diggers, I'm just saying that, you know, it's just natural for a female to want, you know, financial security. They shouldn't be looked at as bad. Just like men, we like to be attracted to the woman that we are with. Most men. I'm not making a blanket statement. But my question was, I noticed that there are some men that can be labeled under the Webster's Dictionary as a chauvinist, right?
Sure.
Just like there are women who are feminists. But my question to you is, why is it that male chauvinism never caught on with the black male collective like feminism caught on with the black female collective?
Well, I think that's really interesting that you... I think most feminists would be offended for you, you know, by suggesting that they're chauvinistic or they have the same kind of ideology as chauvinism. But, you know, I think that's certainly debatable. I think womanists would certainly agree, or people like Elaine Brown or witches would agree that there is a kind of anti-maleism associated with some, you know, neoliberal brands of feminism. But I think two things happen. So one, I think that when you look at black feminism, you're looking at an articulation of black women wanting to insert themselves into history and to disciplines and certain political entities, which is fair, right? I think that that's a good thing. But I think that one of the ways that it became denatured very quickly or distorted is that it's a bourgeois movement. It's a movement that exists mostly amongst educated, middle-class black women that that presupposes them to be authors of black female reality in such a way that overlooks their class positionality and class privilege. So what that means is that when you talk about poor black women who don't identify as being feminist, who don't see the black feminist movement as anything worthwhile, or some go to the extent of saying that it's contrary to their own racial and gendered interests, what you have is a backlash where black feminists in the academy insist that these women are misinformed, that they don't understand their own reality. So I think that that's the major break. So black feminism caught on, yes, but it caught on amongst a certain class demographic, right? People in the academy, people who are educated, people who have degrees. The reason that, you know, the kind of male chauvinism that you talk about where people believe that women have certain positions, the reason that I don't think that catches on so much in black culture generally is because there's so much empirical experiences beyond that, right? So let's say that a black man says, I don't think my woman should work, right? The reality of the situation is that unless that guy is educated and highly successful, black people, to make ends meet, have to work. Over 50% of black households are run by mothers. They're head of the households. They have to work. So the kinds of gendered attitudes that black men have are going to be much more aligned with their realities, which are black women work outside the house, and black women generally are leaders. So when you look at the actual longitudinal data, the attitudinal studies about black men going all the way back to the 1980s that are measuring things like, you know, voter participation, black men who believe black women should be political leaders, black men who believe that sexism is an issue alongside racism, when you look at those types of things, black men overwhelmingly score higher than white women, white men, and equal or greater to black women. So black men have been socialized many times in the communities where they say, listen, we understand that black women both lead, that they both work, that they should work, and they're dealing with other issues of gender, etc. So it's part of the sociology. Like, they don't exist in a world where they control black women in that way. And given that since the 1950s, you know, depending where you want to start it, I mean, some people are on the turn of the century, you know, black women have always been the most educated and the most socially mobile. So there's no way that working class, uneducated black men can tell socially mobile, educated black women, you know, kind of what their place is, because they just don't have the power or the resources to compete in the same markets as black women. Now, most feminists will respond to that. It's like, oh, well, the church. But not every black person is Christian, and not every black person believes in the same dogma. In other words, people constantly go to church and say that certain things are sins, but on Saturday night, they're doing exactly what they believe is a sin. So there are people that have complicated and disidentifying relationships with the church and Christianity all the time. So I think that there has to be a position between us actually studying black culture and what black men and black women think and what their gender relationships are, and put that and compare that to what black feminism says. Because if you listen to, you know, kind of doctrinaire black feminist thought, the idea is that black men and black communities are pathological, patriarchal, domineering, etc. But then all the empirical data that we have in terms of their attitudes and the way they relate to women is contrary to that. So I think that's the reason for the distance, right? That black feminism appeals to a certain economic class of black women, and that's fine because they're fighting different battles in their social spaces. But the majority of black women who are working class don't have the same relationship, both either to men or patriarchy or their communities, the same way that people theorize.
Oh, okay. Thanks for explaining that a little bit. I have one more short little question. I'm going to just mute my line. I remember an officer a white female officer sexually assaulted a black male student. The sexual assault was a violent sexual assault. He grabbed his testicles and squeezed
Darren
him
Manning.
First.
Mm-hmm.
Darren Manning?
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything about that. Can what end up happening with that case? Do you know? Could you tell us about it?
Yeah, so, I mean, he tried to press charges. He went to the doctor. They did an expiratory surgery. They found a blood clot. They didn't know if it was a result of trauma or if it was always there. Right? I don't know why you would have a blood clot in your testicles if you're sick, but you know. And I think that there was, I don't remember seeing a settlement, so I'm assuming the charges were dropped.
Oh, okay. But they didn't go for a lawsuit on them?
No, not that I remember, because I actually put that case in my book, and at the time, which was about 3 or 4 months ago, There wasn't a lawsuit pending to my knowledge, but I mean, I could certainly check on it. But, you know, after the exploratory surgery, they were trying to suggest that it wasn't based on the trauma from the police officer grabbing his testes. So, you know, that's just how stuff goes. I mean, black men are assaulted all the time.
Can I ask you a question? Do you think that there could be a link? I don't know. I'm just saying. Do you think that there could be a link, like how they do cavity searches and, like, that situation there with them grabbing the guy's balls and squeezing them until they burst? Like, I wonder, could that be, like, the police really, I'm just make it quick, fast, really are sexually molesting black males?
Absolutely.
Just like on that movie Crash, when they sexually molested that woman and her husband couldn't do nothing about it.
Yeah, actually, the article that I was talking about, Eschatological Dilemmas, makes that exact argument. It says that there's been a history of racial violence that's included sexual violence against black men. I list a lot of cases. Like, you know, in Chicago, this guy named Caprez Kofi was anally penetrated by a screwdriver. This guy, Angel Perez, was anally penetrated by a gun. Darren Manning, as you're mentioning. So there's lots of cases. You know, the most famous, of course, being Amadou Diallo, where black men are, Lumna, being anally penetrated by a bathroom plunger. So there's lots of cases where police are sexually violating and raping black men very visibly and very publicly. But people are not doing anything about it. So that's what I argue, is that much of the violence against black men is in fact sexual violence, but it gets coded as racial violence in our understanding. So we never look at the fact that many black men are anally penetrated, their genitalia are either manipulated or fondled, right? I mean, there's videos on YouTube where people are laughing, where black men are being stopped and frisked, and they're grabbing their penis, and they're like, oh, well, what is this? Is that a weapon? And he's like, no, it's my penis. So if you can imagine if they're videotaping this, imagine what happens, you know, in stop and frisks, where these young black and brown men are complaining that they've been fondled, harassed, manipulated, penetrated, et cetera, by officers. All right. So, I mean, yeah, sexual harassment, violation, coercion, and rape of black and brown men by the police is something that has a very long historical record. But again, you see, this is what I'm saying, is the relationship between the academy and the public. People don't write about it, so the public's not educated about it, right? And this is the dilemma, that most of the things that the public knows about is trapped within a popular discourse of what people says is and is not happening in the university. Because if it's not if you don't have research in the university, it doesn't make it to, like, blogs or to, you know, podcasts or to other outlets that are doing, you know, kind of social, intellectual, or public intellectual work. So people in mass don't know about it. And while you have people like Thomas Foster, you have my work, you have some historical work by, like, Hose, things like that, the public's not picking those up and, you know, reading them off the bat, because largely they're behind paywalls and their academic works. So until we get a conversation started about the relationship between police violence and the history of sexual assault, sexual coercion, and rape, then people are still going to ignore the accounts that these young black and brown men are giving, saying that, look, police are sexually violating us, they're sexually coercing us into, you know, through sodomy or through, you know, anal penetration or whatnot. You know, these are very real issues, you know.
Absolutely. Abner Louima, I think, person you're referencing. In fact, we talked about this very subject when Dr. Curry was on the program before, and even included Eric Garner in New York, because he had filed a complaint before he was killed that he had suffered an anal cavity search in public by NYPD's finest. So absolutely, you can go back in the archives and hear Dr. Curry give more detail about this very subject matter. The caller 1791, did you have a question for Dr. Curry? Last four digits, 1791. 1791, did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
May I lost him?
Maybe we did. Moving to the next. If you hit your mute button or something like that, I'm not sure.
Dr. Curry?
Oh, okay.
Yes, mic check.
Yes, we can hear you.
Peace, Dr. Curry. I am enjoying this in-depth conversation you're having. You mentioned a little earlier the different titles of black people, colored people, Negroes, African Americans. You shared a couple of different effects that those titles have, and politically, you know, society-wide. Many of us, of course, the vast majority of us, are to that, you know, have our ancestry coming from slavery, taking that boat ride against our will. But in addition, you know, many of us have Blackfoot. Many of us have Cherokee. Many of us have the various Native American tribes that we are linked to in our lineage. So the title Moor, you know, if you could give some insight into taking on that title, more specifically Moorish American, there are individuals that advocate for this political ideology or identification for numerous benefits, legally, lawfully, taking on the Declaration of Human Rights, saying that indigenous people have certain rights to name themselves, to be, you know, sovereign, etc. So if you could kind of build on that topic, the title of Moor, and what that means or may mean to a group of people who suffers in need of identification.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, in the 19th century, I mean, cause, you know, that's the time period I study in ethnology. You don't really find a lot of work on Moors per se. So, you know, I think one of the earliest people that I've seen write about this from the black, you know, from black people in the 20th century was Ellen, was actually Drusilla Dungy Houston. And one of the things that she was arguing was about the ways that Moore situated and interacted with Ethiopians and Egyptians. So I know that in popular parlance, there's a movement to claim Moore as kind of original man as a reclamation of, you know, kind of pre-white supremacist racial identification. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I think Egyptologists, somebody like Tristan Samuels will probably be, you know, more informed, more historically informed on it. But I think the search for identity, you know, the question you started off with, the search for identity kind of outside of, you know, name yourself based on the situations that you find yourself in relation to white supremacy is important. I just don't know what that name would be. So I don't know if us picking Moors and claiming some, you know, kind of pre-colonial ancestry or North African civilizational notion is better than anything we come up with in the American context. Because we have to remember that all history and the way that we identify ourselves through labels are going to be partially invented. So the reason that a lot of people like calling themselves African American is because they don't want to locate their history within purely within slavery, and they want to talk about it in terms of the advances and contributions they made to the American to America as a country, etc. The same thing happens in black, right? I mean, I prefer black because the way that I read history locates me, it locates my relation to white people in an antagonistic way. So black operates perfectly for that notion. It's a sign both of my political sentiment, but also the way I read my historical genealogy. I think Moore probably functions the same way, especially with it outgrowing with some, you know, extensions into, you know, Islam and the way that Islamic scholars are, you know, contemporary Islamic scholars, that's also utilized the term. I honestly can't give a value judgment if it's better or worse than any other term that people read back, you know, historically, though. I mean, that would, you know, more so would be my opinion rather than, you know, the opinion of a medieval or biblical scholar or pre-colonial scholar. You know?
We had three final callers. Do you have time to get our last three callers?
Sure, sure.
Right on. The person that called in, 9041, did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Yes, hi, Dr. Curry. Hi, I'm just a huge fan of yours. I mean, you've definitely kind of changed the way that I've looked at that. I look at racism, white supremacy, as far as looking at how whites cannot be ignorant. And you know, I've been reading a lot of your texts, and I'll follow you on Twitter. Two quick questions for you.
Sure.
I'm an activist down in the Bay Area, and one of the problems that I've been having is that when I engage with large swaths of black people, it's a like many folks have a tendency to try to center black women as well as black gay people, and I'm not trying to erase who they are, because obviously black gays and black women have a different struggle than say a black straight male such as myself. But I kind of feel like that we kind of miss the fact that, well, you know, someone like Sandra Bland, she did not get lynched in jail because she was a woman, but she got lynched because she was black. Mm-hmm. Or say why black trans people are killed. They're not necessarily killed because they're trans. They're killed because they're black. So I wanted to just ask you, what are some tips that I can implement to sort of get this sort of line of thinking across without being sort of insensitive to who they are?
Brother, that's the million-dollar question. I don't think that some of these identity politics are negotiable, to be quite honest with you, right? I mean, because, you know, it's just like I was saying, you know, my work constantly involves depicting how many black women and how many different groups are killed. But, you know, if I report those numbers, for example, like I gave a paper and I reported the numbers of police deaths. And, you know, I was like, this is how many black men were killed, black women were killed, white women, white men. You know, and people were like, well, you're erasing black women. My point was like, listen, I'm reporting, right? It says 12. So do you want me to, you know, and the question, do you want me to change the number? You know, that's what I'm saying. Like, at some point we have a peripheral, a contingent notion of a fact, right? A probabilistic fact. And as much as we can argue with that fact, that's the reality that presents itself. Now, that's not to say that their lives, and I don't understand the whole identity calculus. So if I tell you that 300 black men have been killed and 9 black women have been killed, so if I report that number, does that mean that these 9 lives are worth less than of the 300? You know, and that's the calculus that we're dealing with now. So I don't know how you get outside of people that impose that limit on you, because what you're fighting for is not the objective truth of the matter at time T or right now. You're fighting for what they suggest is their rightful space of recognition, which is to say that even though the majority of victims are X, we want them to be Y, and the fact that we want them to be Y suggests they should be equal to X or more important than X, right? Because I don't know, in the issue of police brutality, like take Sandra Bland, for instance. You know, the problem I have with the Academy is they're acting like that's the first time a black person was ever killed in jail.
Right.
Like, so all the, you know, and it was phrased in such a simplistic way. They're like, all the black men get shot, but she was killed in jail. I'm like, yeah, but black men die in jail all the time. Like, you know, they're like the guy Broder, he was in jail for 3 years and tried to commit suicide like multiple times until he succeeded. You know, so I just don't understand. I guess I don't understand the aversion to facts. Like, Sandra Bland was tragic. But what happened to Sandra Bland isn't anything that doesn't happen to any marginalized group of people. It happens to indigenous people. It happens to poor brown people. It happens to poor white people. It happens to all these group of people. The problem is the proportion of the harm. And that's what I keep telling people, that gender is not about only unique consequences happen to unique people. Gender suggests that there's accumulation of certain consequences around certain groups of people, such that things like police brutality disproportionately accumulate around maleness. And you could say something like, you know, reported cases of rape accumulate around black femaleness, right? These are not, that doesn't mean that black men are not raped. It just means that there's a disproportionate accumulation of that problem around certain groups. And if we don't, and if you think that your identity means that only this only happens to you, then that's why you're getting into those kinds of arguments, right? Because they want this space. And I don't know how you negotiate that, to be quite honest with you. I'm horrible at it because as a scholar, I just have no tolerance for the argument, right? I have tolerance for you. If you come to me and say black women are dying by cops, I'm like, you're absolutely right. We should understand if that's different, we should understand how and why. But if you come to me and say black women are equal victims to police brutality as black men, then that's just false. It's not true. So I don't know, and that's what I mean. Like, I don't know how to have that argument with you. Because you're expecting me to argue with you about something that we could prove is false, right? It's the same thing with, like, you know, domestic violence. You know, I went on a job interview. It was like, listen, we did a study that proves, statutory rape, and abuse of young black boys with black women matches up to some of the arguments that we found in terms of young sexual abuse, child abuse, and domestic abuse that's been present in the literature for 40 years. They're like, well, I just don't think that's true. I was like, I don't know how to argue with you. And I was like, I'm not arguing with you, but I don't know how to convince you that something that we've proven is true for 50 years is not true. Right? Like, I don't, you know. So the problem is the negotiation. Right. And I think right. that what you ultimately have to do is you're going to have to say, listen, while I'm sensitive to this position and I'm more than willing to discuss this position, like the facts of the matter that, yes, black women are killed, black trans peoples are killed, black gay people are killed, right? That's not under dispute. There's no way that we can have a serious argument if your only way of advancing is suggesting that these identities, which are, you know, dozens at this point, you know, dozens per year, you know, compared to hundreds. I was like, I don't understand how that's fruitful. And if you're suggesting that I have to concede to you my position in the victimization of this group that I'm vastly interested in that are disproportionately affected by this kind of violence, then I don't think there's any way forward. Right. And imagine if you reverse the situation, right? I mean, black men are roughly about 40, depending on the year, 35 to 40% of intimate partner violence, domestic violence situations. At no point in this country would they ever say, let's make black men the face of domestic violence.
Not at all. Not at all.
They would never do that, right?
Not at all.
Now, and I'm not saying that we should, because I'm not into the identity politics. I think you should talk about all victims, and you should focus resources on the people who are most disproportionately affected, not ignore the other population, but you need to deal with victims. And so in that world, I'm not going to say that if black women are in need, you should neglect them. I will say that you need to divert more resources to poor black to men in general, but poor black and brown men especially, because there's no shelters. You know, when we were trying to conduct this IRB study, there was not a shelter that we could send people to specifically for, you know, black male for male sexual abuse. But given that, these are about facts, right? Like,
right.
And if they want to bring up other facts, then we can certainly debate those facts. But you can't have an argument to say, well, even though these 300 people outnumber these 10, 12, or 20, whatever the case may be, these 300 black men's lives are worth less because they're straight and male than these other people. That's the problem that I have. So,
and that's what I'm coming across, Dr. Curry. And it's like whenever I try to say, well, look, well, you know, it's a fact statistically, you know, and I like to back something that Gus always says, I like to back up my argument with logic. So I'll just tell him statistically, black men are killed at far greater rates. So why would we put more emphasis on a group that is not as terrorized? Not saying that their lives are worth any less, but it just seems like that once again, we come in the tropes with, okay, black men are being sexist. Black women aren't being heard. And it's just like, it's so ridiculous. And it makes me so frustrated, actually.
Well, I understand the frustration, but it's like I said, I mean, it's the theories that people are working with. So if you take an intersectional theory, for them, they're going to say, oh, black men are getting the credit. And this is what I'm saying. It's just so morally deplorable about the argument. Black men get killed, but they're on TV more because they're getting killed more. And that's erasing black women. Right. Versus saying in a system of white supremacy, there's a certain vulnerability, you know, and that's what I'm saying about the domestic, like, no, I mean, imagine if black men start saying black women are privileged because they're being beaten or killed more by men. People would lose their minds, right? Like, if you even said that's a privilege, but given, you know, the invisibility thesis, androcentricity is a privilege, even if it means black men are incarcerated or killed more. So this becomes a problem of how we understand. This is why I'm saying, like, you know, racial chauvinism and racial misandry really have to be dealt with, because what you have that's not stated in that premise is that black male life is worth less than other lives. And that, to me, that's an unacceptable premise that needs to be directly challenged. And I don't know if that has to be challenged amongst activists, you know, because now they call people that do that hotepers. I don't know all the language.
Dude,
but, you know, it certainly has to be challenged in the academy, you know, because the issue is not erasing anybody. But you can't keep asserting that 65,000 black women who are incarcerated is the same as 800,000. That's not and that's not black men saying, hey, erase them. That's black men saying that clearly there's a disproportionate problem between the populations. If you want to go study black women in jail and you want to write, nobody's saying not to. It's not like I'm not going to share the article. It's not like I'm not going to cite the article. But you can't dictate that that interest somehow should censor everyone else's interest if I'm worried about the 800,000, right? And I think that's, again, this is the conflation of identity politics. And it revolves around maleness because it's not reciprocal for femaleness. You can't, I mean, despite the numbers of rape that's going to increase over the years because they've redefined the federal definition of rape and the increased number that we find, you know, the constantly rising number of domestic abuse we find amongst men generally, nobody's going to be like, well, you know, men are generally erased, you know, because the way that they found the theory is they think that domestic abuse is caused by men. It's completely false. The originator of Duluth herself, Ellen Pence, said that, you know, we made it up. But that doesn't deter people. So this is an ideological argument. It's not a logical argument.
We'll leave it there, sir, because we have other people that haven't.
Nope. No problem.
For sure. The person is 6048. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Hello. Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for taking my call. Most of the questions that I had were kind of answered, but I do have one question. I know you're talking about, I guess, in the academic sphere, the difficulty or just kind of share your experiences and trying to kind of share this information across, I guess, you know, different colleges, like maybe like the College of Business or education and things like that, and have you been successful or not?
Well, I think with most things, it's kind of half and half, right? I mean, the kind of work that I do on black men is not really done in the academy generally, and it's certainly not done in the field of philosophy. So philosophy is ultra-liberal, it's ultra-feminist, so people are not really receptive to arguments against white women or even questioning the history of black feminism. I find that to be interesting because most of the people I depend on are all black women historians, right? It's not like I'm going up here like, oh, black feminists are all wrong. It's like, well, no, you've misread certain tenets of history that historians have, you know, worked for the last decades trying to correct that would change our view of things, right? So, like, if we accept Martha S. Jones' argument that, you know, black men have always been allies, were amongst some of the most progressive pro-woman activists even before women, like in the National Negro Convention, then that would fundamentally change the argument that black men have never been interested in gender, right? If we believe, you know, Melissa Stein's work, that gender arises as a concept, like as an official concept off the back of free black men and their relationship to white women, then it certainly doesn't mean that black men had no notion of this concept of gender. It may not apply to them, but it didn't revolve around womanhood in the way that people want to say. It wasn't about white women's vulnerability or, you know, pro-rights activism, right? It was about them being different from rapists or what they define as rapists, right? See, this is the argument that seems to upset a lot of people, despite the fact that, as I say, these are facts. Now, we could question the interpretation I have, but you got to wrestle with the facts, right? And I think in disciplines like philosophy and liberal arts generally, people don't want to talk about facts as the basis of how we create theory. We much rather theorize and then kind of use, you know, experiential kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy or circular reasoning to suggest we can read everything by this theory and suggest that us interpreting the world, you know, narcissistically really, but through our own view gives proof of the theory. And that's not how theory should work. If we develop theories, we should be able to test them. So, I mean, I think both the kind of historical, sociological, and empirical bend of my work, especially when it comes to black males, isn't really accepted in my field. But that doesn't, of course, mean that, I mean, I've got great reception amongst lots of different people, you know, in critical race theory, you know, Richard Delgado, Kenneth Nunn. These are people who've been very, very supportive of the types of moves I'm trying to make. You know, even William A. Smith, you know, in terms of racial battle fatigue, his work on black men and boys is groundbreaking. So, you know, I mean, there are just different scholars that people, you know, resonate with. And, you know, there are a lot of up-and-coming scholars that I think, you know, find my work informative. So, you know, these things take time, and anytime you try to do something different, the academy punishes you rather than rewards you. So, you know, we'll just have to see how it ends up. Again, I think that it just puts it starts to put the onus now on black scholars to actually be able to kind of verify or at least attempt to verify some of their theories rather than simply claim them to be true by them in and of themselves. Right.
Okay, maybe, I don't know, maybe I asked the question wrong. And I mean, I understand, like, your field, but, like, you know, the things you think about how they manifest and, like, education, or, like, how they,
manifesting like medicine. Like this morning, I was watching the news one, and they were talking about how the black men who are homosexual and, you know, how they not being treated properly and how Atlanta, I guess, is turning into some horrible HIV place. I guess I'm talking like more like that, like taking it from philosophy and applying it to medicine. Those types of people.
Well, look, but I mean, if you're talking about that, I mean, then I just think that you got a real situation that, you know, black gay men, black men generally, but especially black gay men, are being underserved by the medical establishment. I mean, in terms of populations, I mean, God, I was reading, it's not Deborah Pager. I think it may be Becky Pettit, but I mean, there was a woman who was making an argument saying that the economic and the fact that black men are poor, the poorest, and are incarcerated at such high rates are part of the reason that we don't actually know their mortality or their health conditions. And, you know, so the problem is that oppression also breeds disease, right? So when you have poor people who are working class, that are working, literally working their bodies to the grave, when you have people who have alternative lifestyles, but you don't educate them about the risks of that lifestyle and you don't change the system to address the kinds of risk that comes with that, then you're going to have these kinds of problems. And see, again, this is what always frustrates me. My wife is a sociologist, so she studies black women's health specifically, and we're constantly talking about how the various identities of black men and women means that there has to be public policy that's able to address the health and mortality issues that affect each group. So if I'm a black male and I know that my risk of getting HIV is 2 to 3 times the general public, then that means that we have to step up education efforts and preventative measures to that group, because that disease propensity affects them. You know, and this is, and like I say, this is an issue not of identity politics, but of just public policy and public health, you know? And, you know, but we don't do this, you know? And that's, again, that's the frustrating part, is that we don't, like you're saying, we don't marry theory, because we believe fundamentally that, like, black women are double or triple depressed, whatever they say, but we have so few conversations about black women's health. You know, how does they get the highest degrees, but how does working in white environments affect them? How does social mobility affect them? How does diet affect them? How does food availability affect them? How does, you know, all these, you know, black women, you know, more often not have premature births, like early births. How does this affect them, children? What's the health care? All these kind of things are things that we should be asking if we're serious about talking about black women, or we're talking about black queer bodies, or if we're talking about black male mortality, but none of these things are addressed. And that's what I'm saying is the gap, right? That's the gap between our notions of theories and picking these bodies that we want and then addressing them in the real world. So, no, I mean, I agree with you, but I mean, we're a long way from that. I mean, most of the stuff that we deal with today on race is just identity, and, you know, I deserve to be X because I'm this person with this color skin and this sexuality. So we have a long way to go.
Sure. Last caller, the retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry? You should be with us.
Yes, greetings.
Yes, sir.
And greetings, Dr. Curry. Two questions. You probably already talked about them. the vote, specifically, Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. Is there any dramatic difference between the two, to where it would make some sort of constructive output with non-white black people that we should be putting out all of our attention to, like it's kind of presented itself, or should it something else that we should be doing collectively?
I mean, given the electoral process, there's not much else that we can do collectively, right? The system set up, I mean, you know, that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, as much as we think of politics at the grassroots levels in terms of movement, in terms of revolt, things like that, we got to recognize there are governments, there are systems, and there are structures that will persist much longer than any of us will live. That being said, I think the difference is the ways that these candidates fit into the system. So I think that Donald Trump largely believes in a kind of corporatist model. So most of his arguments are purely about job creation, strong economics, and really domination. I haven't heard him speak too much about militarism, but most of his stuff is about, you know, corporatism. I think with Hillary Clinton, we're dealing with a very, very different person. Hillary Clinton, because she's been part of the establishment of the Secretary of State, I think she has kind of a real politic. Like, she's an international, I think she's a realist. Like, I think she thinks that there are certain balances of power that different states have, and that you the stronger your state is, the more you can influence people. I think she's a very hard power type person. The problem is, I think that's very, very dangerous in a world where she has control over the military, because her vision, if she views international relations that way, then she really does believe in, like, intervention and kind of this deterrence mentality of the world. And I see that to be extremely dangerous. I see that to be a very, very dangerous view. And I think that also reflects in terms of how she looks at domestic policy. So if you think of the super predator comment she made about certain groups of people, keep saying black people, but it's really black men. DeLillo's argument was that black men are being birthed by poor black women who have no fathers. So these black women are criminogenic, which means that you're going to have black men without fathers who are going to become criminals. So that was the argument that was happening around the crime bill in the mid-90s. I think that reflects her larger racial politics, because what she believes is that there are fundamental groups of people who are criminal and who are dangerous to civilization. And if that's how, if she handles the world the way she handles domestic policy, which I think she will, then I think that ultimately what we're looking at is someone who will concede that there just has to be death to maintain a balance of power across the world. And I think that's a very, very dangerous proposition to have. It's kind of Thatcherism, rather than any notion of democracy or a democratic president that I think we'd recognize. So I think it's very, very worrying. Trump is just a blind racist and xenophobe. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to be a better president, but he doesn't seem to be as interventionist as Hillary Clinton. But, you know, that doesn't mean that he won't be. It's just that he doesn't seem to be right now, at least in my view.
Mr. George Zimmerman and the auctioning of the murder weapon starting at $5,000. What, in your opinion, is that a reflection not only on this murdered child's family, but non-white black people in general?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that's a reflection of just, you know, like I say in my work, I think that's, you know, it's a reflection of how feared, you know, racially subordinate males are in this society. It's a reflection of racial misandry, right? There is a fundamental hate of black males in this country. And I think that the fact that we don't admit this, despite all the statistics and the realities that show us otherwise, the fact that we don't want to deal with the fears and the phobias that are associated with black male life and death, really doesn't give us a rich analysis of what's happening either to black men and boys or what's happening under white patriarchy. And again, this is the problem I have when we don't study things as they actually are and just try to extend our ideologies as far as they will go. One of the reasons that I think intersectional visibility came about, well, in fact, I know one of the reasons intersectional visibility came about is because they couldn't answer this argument on social dominance, was that, listen, if your argument about patriarchy is true, why do all these men of color keep dying at vastly higher rates than women of color and white women, right? So they had a changed interpretation of it. So I think the auction of the gun is symbolic of the ways in which we think that the life of racialized males in this country don't matter. I mean, because this is, again, you have to understand that historically, killing black men was a symbol of freedom, right? Lynching a black man was a sign of white people's rights. Women's rights, you know, in society, are white men's rights economically, because they didn't compete with them. So it is no surprise, given that history that ranges all the way up to the 1960s, is still relevant in the minds of many white people today. The gun is a symbol. It's an heirloom, right? This was a gun that killed a black man. It's the same way that people used to keep the lynch rope and the various body parts of black men who were lynched. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what to tell people about that, except, you know, we have to change the frame that we use to look at these issues. You know, there's a problem. We keep getting things wrong, so we need to create new theories that get it right. You know, this is what created, you know, feminism, which I think, you know, had its place, had an intervention to make. This is the place of queer theory. This is the new work on trans identity and disidentification. That's why all these theories come about. So we need something that can explain the symbolism of the gun in relationship to the murder and mutilation of black men and boys. And, you know, until we start understanding the kind of homoerotic and necrophilic, you know, this obsession with dead black men's bodies that America has, then I think we're going to keep missing the point. I mean, because, you know, it's nonsensical. The idea that a murder weapon could be auctioned off and people are like, yeah, this is a great American heirloom, right? The Smithsonian, you know, wanted it, which the Smithsonian says they didn't say they wanted it. But nonetheless, that's what this, you know, George Zimmerman claimed. You know, this is absolutely ridiculous, right? So.
All right.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Glad we could nab the folks that dialed in. Before we let you go, Dr. Curry, you always have just an array of fantastic books that you recommend. I know you mentioned Picking Cotton before, The Delectable Negro, just lots of...
Picking Cotton actually threw me off. I couldn't understand that book at all. Brother, I tried. I just couldn't understand why you want to befriend your accused, but, you know.
That was Reconciliation, I think, was the name. Like, And anything that you would encourage folks to check out that you've seen since we last spoke to you? Any books? I know you have your projects coming out that we'll be looking for, but anything else that you
I'd recommend this book. You know, there's very few books that I read that I'm just like, you know, I thought this was an awesome book. I actually had to call the author and tell her I thought her book was really well done. It's called Measuring Manhood by Melissa Stein. She's a author. I think she's in Women and Gender Studies at the University of Kentucky. It's just a really good book on the development of the notion of gender and actually like what kind of science and threats were used to construct the sexuality of black men. It's an excellent book. It reads really nicely. So, you know, I think that would be probably my top recommendation right now. It's just a really well done book. And it really does support a lot of the things that I've been arguing, but other historians have been arguing about the concept of black maleness in the 19th century. So it's really, really well done.
Got it. We will see if we can do some work on that as well. Always a pleasure to have Dr. Curry with us on the program. It has been a pleasure to hear your views for the last few hours. We will definitely be looking forward to having you on the program again with us soon. Hopefully the next time that you're here, your book will be published, or one of your books.
Hopefully.
So that we can talk about that as well. Definitely continue with your outstanding and much needed work. We will be following, checking. I will link so that people can go to your academia.edu page to download any of the reports, the one that I read from this evening. And you have a lot of other reports that people can download for free, as you said. So I'll link to that as well. But thank you so much for speaking with us again, Dr. Curry. And we will be eagerly looking forward to the next time that we can hear from you.
Oh, thank you, sir. I'm always humble.
For sure. Take excellent care. Keep up the outstanding work, Dr. Curry. Good evening.
All right, good evening, sir.
Yes, sir. Context of White Supremacy, again, Dr. Tommy Curry. Always grand to have him on the program. His seventh time visiting the Context of White Supremacy. Delectable Negro is really good. He mentioned that, I think, a couple years back when he was on the program. I've referenced it quite a few times as we have moved through different books and different items have come up. I hope folks got some constructive information from the broadcast. Again, we will be back 24 hours, Medical Apartheid segment 4. Harriet A. Washington, also outstanding reading, tomorrow evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We should be on for the next 3 consecutive days. The compensatory call-in will be this Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, and then our global Sunday talk on racism this coming Sunday. If you have any confusion, problems, can't find something in the archives, a gripe, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. We will try to help out, respond as quickly as possible. When you hit the blog page, the PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop us an email and we will help you get things figured out so you can get a physical mailing address if you would like to support the broadcast. Again, thanks to all the folks who have invested in the program down through the years. I hope that we have provided some constructive information, help folks get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works. We have done actually 3 hours plus, so we'll be wrapping things up. I would just again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, particularly given what Dr. Curry shared about the sexual abuse of black males and black females. You definitely do not want to be intoxicated should you be stopped by Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other officers. Anything could happen. You being intoxicated will only make the situation about 1,000 times worse because they will have even greater justification for any molestation, mauling, killing that they do of you, anybody that happens to be with you. You want to make sure that you are clear thinking, lucid, so you can make the best possible decisions to keep yourself safe, you and, again, anybody that you might be responsible for. Certainly buckle up every time that you are behind the wheel. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. We'll be here tomorrow. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other victims of white supremacy, black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.